Coming up on Boston Public Radio, pay as you throw may be coming to your town. Assessing residents by the bag has reduced trash by as much as 50% in places like Malden and Worcester and 141 other Massachusetts cities and towns. Are you ready? Then it's food guy Corby Cummer on salt warnings on menus and Dunkin' Donuts delivering. Then at noon, we're joined by the producer of a new eye-opening frontline documentary, Growing Up Trans. No Caitlyn Jenners here, just kids.
Harvard Law School's Lawrence Tribe on recent Supreme Court decisions. Nancy Kane on the market basket miracle 1 year later after the beloved enterprise nearly tanked. Then we'll ask you, you stressed out? You 24/7 basket case? Well, here to the rescue, get this, coloring books. All that coming up on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
From a transmitter atop Great Blue Hill, this is WGBH. Live, local talk, Boston Public Radio.
He's Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Good morning, Jim.
Hey there, Marjorie. So we're, I guess you could say, trash-talking today with a look at an environmental movement in Massachusetts that is now 143 in municipalities strong. I didn't know that. It's called Pay As You Throw. Here's how it works. Residents are charged for garbage bags, and garbage trucks will not pick up any trash that's not in one of these officially sanctioned bags. They cost roughly $1 for a 15-gallon bag, $2 for a 33-gallon bag. It spares landfills tons of waste. It saves cities tons of money hauling trash. But it also has a lot of residents in some of these communities, places like Worcester, Natick, Malden, some smaller communities, fuming, who retaliate by cheating. They hide their trash, or attempt to anyway, in public waste cans, or they dump their trash on someone else's curb. And so we have a couple of questions for you at 877-301-8970. Is this a great idea and one that should be implemented across the state, not just across the state, across the region? And two, if you live in a place like Malden or Plymouth or Worcester or one of the other 140 cities and towns that has pay as you throw, are you a cheater? Have you dumped your garbage where it doesn't belong, or have you been cheated on, or do you like the program? 877-301-8970. There's a great story in The Atlantic about the Malden piece of this. There's a trash cop. That's not what he's called.
I love this guy.
Who essentially goes around, checks. The easy thing he checks is to see if you're using the proper trash bags. But then if you've tried to cheat by putting it somewhere else, he opens the bag, searches for any identification, including like a pizza box that has your address on it or something. And then you were told if you don't remove the offending thing, whatever it is, within 24 hours, listen to this. This is Malden. I assume it's different in each community. A $300 fine and removal fee. So, but what is beyond dispute, Marjorie, it reduces waste sometimes as much as 50% in 1 year because people want to save the money. They recycle instead of throwing stuff out. Saves a ton of money for cities and towns, obviously environmentally friendly. So we want to know what you think. If you already have it, are you thrilled or are you cheating? I'm assuming most of you are cheating out there. 877-301-8970.
Well, they talk a lot about the cheaters in these stories. They try to, you know, put empty paint cans inside, like, you know, plastic bags, hope they can get away with that, or styrofoam in the recycled bin that's not supposed to be recycled and stuff like that. You know, it's a common thing. I think a lot of people have done this. I've done this.
What's that?
I don't feel like it's really cheating. But, you know, you have those big, huge, blue recycled bins.
Yeah,
now.
We have them in Cambridge.
And sometimes if you have, like, big recyclers, like the people underneath me are really huge recyclers, and sometimes I go out and there's no room.
Put them next door.
Right.
You go up
and down the street. Well, I don't know. I mean,
they don't pay for it.
No,
I mean, that's
I know.
Not
but you don't know if they're about to unload all their stuff or if you're taking their space. But I've gone out in the wee hours with my recycling and dumped it in my neighbor's blue bins. And
there's nothing wrong with that.
Is that okay?
Now, a friend of mine, I can't say who this is, I am told in Cambridge when he or she, in this case, has things that are not only not appropriate trash, but they're not recyclable, what he or she will do is drive around to a trash receptor, you know, the trash cans.
Dumpsters.
And around Cambridge, when no one's looking, drop a paint can in or drop it. But But this thing makes so much sense to me. It really does. The results, I'm not being hyperbolic here, the results in some of these communities, some of them as much as 43 to 50% reduction in trash in year one because people want to save money. It's not like you're just going to get nailed financially if you choose to recycle at a greater rate, which obviously they can in many of these communities. You save money on the trash bags. You save money on trash
hauling. Well, listen to this, that Worcester's pay-as-you-throw program, and Worcester's no small city, has
second biggest in New England.
It saved the city an estimated $10 to $20 million in the past 20 years. That's big money, especially when you're not loaded. And that's one of the incentives here, is that picking up the trash is costing people so much money. I mean, down the Cape, they all have to bring their own trash to the
town dumps,
unless they want to pay extra for somebody to come pick it up.
And have seagulls deposit things in your head, which is what they do.
Well, the town dump's kind of fun. It's always kind of fun to show up there,
not.
And people like to go through.
It smells horrible.
Well,
you
don't want to go on a really hot day. And that was the poor thing about this trash guy from Malden. It gets really gross in the summertime when there are like sort of maggots in the trash.
Well, he's got to sort through the trash to ID the – and what happens, just if people are not clear, if someone decides that they don't want to buy one of the bags, they deposit stuff in a regular bag, which you're not allowed to use in that particular place in Malden, and you leave it on somebody else's deal, he has to sort open it up to find out who the offender is.
Yeah.
The offender lives there, then they get the warning, and if the offender lives somewhere else, then I guess he goes to their house and puts a notice on their door.
But you know what I like about this? There's a communitarian feel about it.
We don't do it in Cambridge.
The money that we don't do it in Brookline either, but the money that you're saving on trash pickup, you can put towards something else that you really need in the city. And when you're talking $10 to $20 million over 20 years, the amount of money you could save and put toward those other things is really huge. I mean, would you rather spend it on trash or would you rather spend it on teachers or a new playground or whatever it is? 877-301-8970. 877-301-8970. But a lot of these towns, as you say, Jim, the citizens are in rebellion.
They're rising up.
And they're dragging their trash bins all over town, trying to sneak it into their neighbors.
And occasionally they're actually even crossing town lines, which, you know, makes it a federal offense. Let's take some calls. Charlene from Natick, actually, which is a community that has this. You are first on Boston Public Radio. Hey, Charlene, thanks for the call.
Oh, thanks for the subject matter. I think it's a great program. Initially, I was angry that I had to pay for the bags, but it was pretty quick. You know, you could see the results of people recycling more. And, you know, I actually have, you know, bought a second recycling bin. The town did dispense really nice recycling bins to everyone. And I've had to buy a second because I'm much more careful about what I put into the trash.
Wait, Charlene, before you continue, my understanding is one of the incentives for people to recycle more is not only do they have to buy fewer trash bags, but in virtually all these jurisdictions, recycling is free. It's not free in Natick?
Oh, no, it is free. The recycling is free, and the recycling bins were just dispensed. We all have uniform recycling bins.
Oh, I got it. Okay.
But if you fill more than that one huge bin that they gave us, you can buy a second. And I actually did, and I feel good about that. And I've noticed many people in the neighborhood have started buying seconds, so they're being more careful about what they're, you know, throwing out in trash. And I don't see a lot of abuse, although I do see less public waste baskets, like in front of, like, the little convenience store no longer has one, because I'm sure what was happening were people weren't, you know, stuffing it to the gills.
Like Marjorie would do.
That's right. Sneaking over there.
Charlene, you sound ecstatic about this thing.
Well, I think it's an easy way to decrease landfill.
So do I.
And I think the towns do make money on the recycling, the amounts that they, you know, recycle. You do get some kind of benefit and payment from that. But I have to admit, you know, I'm not totally the best at this. When I do have something that, you know, like a sofa or a chair or something. I have a cottage in New Hampshire, and I'll schlep it up there because that I can get rid of it at their dump without a problem.
We're proud of you, Charlene.
Like, the purist. I'm not a purist, but I try.
Hey, Charlene, thanks for sharing your story with us. We appreciate it.
You do notice, boy, I've put up a few chairs out in the sidewalk or a few other things out in the sidewalk. You know what's the greatest thing in the world?
No.
A little fairy comes by in the middle of the night and takes them away. I find that wonderful.
You mean people for their apartments and things?
Yeah, people
furniture.
Take them.
Well, that's fine.
People,
you know, just in Worcester alone, I don't know where this article is from, my apologies. It may be actually from Worcester or the city itself. They've saved 10 to 20 million bucks, as much as $1 million a year over the past 20 years, thanks to this Waste Zero program. It's really is the ultimate win-win-win thing. You just have to pay, but you get a lot for what you pay. Tina, you're in Dartmouth. You're next on Boston Public Radio with Jim and Marjorie. Hi there, Tina.
Hi, Jim. Hi, Marjorie.
Hi.
Hello.
First time caller, long time listener.
We love both
thank
things.
Thank you,
thanks,
Tina.
And love your show.
Thank you.
Okay, so in Dartmouth, we have been using this system for I don't know how many years, but quite a few. And I remember hearing quite a bit of anger from local residents initially, but to me, I think if somebody could come up with a better idea to encourage people to recycle, I want to know what it is. Because, Dartmouth is very compliant from what I can see. I see very little people ever putting anything out that doesn't belong in those. And I also see, I think it just makes you so much more conscious of trying to recycle, number one, but also you become more conscious of what ends up getting recycled.
I think that's a great point. I'm glad you made that. That is a great point. What you say? You think the compliance rate is high in your community, Tina?
Oh, absolutely. I think it's very high. I mean, we're neighbors of Fall River and New Bedford, and those are the towns that are going to be. Those are the towns. Now, how do you encourage those people? Because you're in 3 and 6 family tenements, and so how do you control who's going to recycle and who's not? So I don't know where they're going to go with that. But as far as a rural and a community, a suburban community like we are, I think people are very much in favor and very tied in now to the whole idea of recycling. But one of the things that when I say that people are more conscious of what they recycle, and I just see that even in the grocery stores, when you go up to the meat counter and you get like a 3-inch thick styrofoam thing for a pound of ground beef. Those are the kind of things you're going to be more noticing that when you recycle them now.
Yeah,
good point.
And maybe you'll be more apt to say something to the grocery store manager.
Because you can't recycle styrofoam, right?
Yes. Well, as long as they have that little triangle underneath it, you can recycle.
Oh, I didn't know
so
that.
Some do, some don't.
So plus, Tina, when you go to the butcher now and you get a pound of ground beef, aren't you worried there's going to be a saw in it or something after that whole thing in upstate?
No.
You're not? Okay, just wanted to check.
First, it walks up to the manager and lets him know this stuff. But I also walk up to the manager and let him know the people who work in the store who are lovely and helpful.
Great. Hey, Tina, before you go, where do you buy in Dartmouth? How do you buy the bags? Where do you go?
Which bags are you talking about?
I mean,
recycling bags?
The bags, the whatever you call it, the garbage bags.
You can buy them almost anywhere, like a Benny's, a Stop and Shop.
Oh, at commercial establishments that they.
Yeah,
oh, I see.
$1 for the large ones and $1 for the small ones.
Tina, thanks. That was a great call. Make another one soon. Thanks
Daniel
for
just emailed.
Hearing from you.
He's very concerned that if this happens in Boston, the so-called Alston Christmas will end. And everybody knows what that is. That's when everybody puts out all the furniture and the beds and the couches.
Alston Christmas. That's a great expression.
On the street, and everybody goes by and picks them up. Of course, the problem with that, there has been the bed bug infestation problem where people have taken these things from the street into their apartments. And oh, no. And by the way, what about composting? I mean, I wasn't clear from these articles if composting is free or if that's considered recycling.
I don't know. But you know what word goes along with composting? I know that we'll have listeners who are angry, particularly in urban areas.
What?
Rats. I mean, that's a real serious problem.
What's the worst thing about New York City, where you used to live and where a couple of my kids live now?
Yeah.
In the summertime, when you go to New York and you see, like, outside these big buildings, like 150 garbage bags piled up on the street.
Horrible.
It's disgusting.
The one thing we should say in terms of we're talking about big communities. We heard from somebody from Natick, and there's Malden, and there's Worcester, obviously fairly large communities. While 40% of the cities and towns in the state are covered, it only covers 20% of the households. And the point of that is, if it gives you a headache, is that means the vast majority of communities in the state who have done it are smaller communities. The Dartmouths and the even smaller kinds of communities, and most major cities. Cambridge hasn't done it. Brookline, you say, hasn't done it. Boston.
The do-gooders in Cambridge
are exactly
all over
what
this.
I was thinking. Also, they win all these environmental awards. This is one of the most environmentally friendly cities in America. I don't know if Somerville's doing it. Another city that prides itself on this.
The man to lead the charge.
Let me tell you. Middle of the night. Wearing a mask, driving around in a black Highlander, looking for cameras, and there we are.
Okay. We are talking about this pay-as-you-throw program, charging money for how much garbage you put out. Is this a good move for the environmental movement, or is it spoiling the neighborhood, turning people like Jim into cheaters, slithering around in the wee hours? The conversation continues on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie. We've all heard of cheating on your taxes. What about cheating on your trash? Across the state, 143 municipalities, covers 20% of the households, have implemented the pay-as-you-throw program. And the idea is this. You pay for the amount of garbage you throw out while it's working to save tons of money and landfills the burden of trash. There are a lot of people, we haven't heard from many, who aren't playing by the rules. They're dumping their trash in other people's curbs, dumping it in public waste cans, committing trash fraud, I guess you could say, trying to hide it in recycling bins. We forgot about that one. Or they dump it in public trash cans. We're asking you, is pay-as-you-throw something that should be statewide, region-wide? Is it working in your town if you're one of the 143? Are you among the garbage cheaters, or have you ever been the victim of one? 877-301-8970. Now, this is one of these things. Where is there a rational argument against it? I mean, other than somebody saying, well, I pay my property taxes, so I should be able to throw out whatever I want, wherever I want, whenever I want. I'll recycle what I choose to recycle. What, I mean, which is really sort of
Well, that is sort of the argument, right? People are saying, I pay enough of my property taxes, you should pick up the garbage.
Yeah, but you say the response to that, I assume, if I'm running a city or town, is I can reduce your property taxes, at least, as you say, spend that extra money instead of on landfill or whatever. I can spend it on a teacher or a cop or a firefighter. So I it's one of those things where other than sort of stubborn resistance, I'm trying hard to come up with an argument against it, but I like it. I'm surprised it hasn't been said. We should ask Charlie Baker next time he's in here why this hasn't or has this been considered as a statewide initiative.
You know, if you had a choice in a Proposition 2 override and a recycling program, I think you might say the Proposition 2.5 override would be less upsetting to people than the
less upsetting than a recycling program raising their taxes
is less upsetting than a recycling.
Less upsetting?
I think so.
Wait, people are more resistant to recycling than they are to tax.
No, I'm saying if you had a choice between raising your voting for a 2.5 override and costing yourself a lot more in property taxes, just saying forget the override, we're going to go to recycling.
Oh, you?
I think
fine,
people would
I agree.
Absolutely go to recycling.
I agree with that. Let's go to Aaron and Wellesley. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Hey there, Aaron.
Hey, how you guys doing?
We're great, thanks.
Number one, your guys' show is great. I listen to it every day in my shop.
Well, thank you very much.
Number two, when I lived in Seattle, I was a student out there. I used to have to be the trash cop. Basically, all the neighbors would pile their trash in our tiny trash can that five of us lived in one house in.
Really?
I just threw it. Oh, yeah, every day.
Why you?
I think we were the only people that had a trash can on the block or something. They'd stick all their trash in there, and then you'd have to sift through it and figure out who it went to.
So wait a second.
It back to their front door.
So that's what I was going to say. So like that, did you literally do that? You'd find an ID and you'd return it to them?
Yeah. You'd show up and sometimes they'd open the door and you're there dumping trash on it. But you know, for the most part, they'd just kind of look at you like you were crazy. And you know, but we had one of these little tiny trash cans. It was like a 20-gallon trash can. There was five guys living in one place.
Wow.
Good for you, Aaron.
Did you say you were in Seattle?
Yeah.
Yeah, I was in Seattle. I went to the University of Washington.
Yeah, I would think Seattle would be another one of those places. You know, I think of Seattle, Washington, Portland, Oregon are sort of like very progressive on the environmental stuff. I would think they would have this kind of thing there.
Well, now they've got it so you have to recycle. You put compost in one bin. You have to put glass in one. You know, it's a little more complicated than it is here. But
So, Aaron, you said you listen in your shop. What do you do in a shop?
I restore and make French horn.
You are kidding me.
Wow.
You restore and that is fabulous.
Wow.
I work on all brass instruments, but mostly the fabrication end is now more going to French horn. We're coming up with the prototypes and then going that direction.
That is great. You know, if you ever get tired of that, you can become a trash cop. You've obviously got some experience, Aaron. Hey, Aaron, stay on hold about the French horn. We'd love to be in touch with you at some point.
Hang on
just for a second. Could you take down Aaron's phone number and we'll check him out at some point? 877-301-8970. We're talking about pay as you throw. It's a program which, again, I know it was news to me, and I think to Marjorie. 143 cities and towns in Massachusetts do it. It's 40% of the communities, 20% of the households are covered, obviously because they're mostly smaller communities other than the Natick's and the Worcesters, et cetera. And we want to know what you think, and we're searching for somebody who thinks it's a bad idea. We haven't found anybody. We're not screening calls.
William's complaining a little bit.
Oh,
he says, I'm from Plymouth, Massachusetts, and biggest issue is we have to pay $180 a year to just be able to get curbside pickup. On top of that, we have to pay for the trash bags. In theory, recycling is not free because you have to pay for curbside pickup.
That's a decent point, is
it
not?
The alternative is to pay to be able to go to the dump, and then you have to still pay for the trash bag. So
you really like going? Do you have to go to the dump on the Cape? Or,
yes.
And that you enjoy that?
It was always a big thing for the kids. Let's go to the dump.
It's disgusting.
Exciting. Well, there are a lot of seagulls. It's true.
And it smells absolutely
it does. Summertime,
atrocious.
it can be bad.
So what's the fun part?
Well, there's a lot of things there that people leave there. You know, you can kind of like a really low rent yard sale. You know what I mean?
Oh, there's nothing like, I'll tell you. I go to a landfill and I see a pile of smelly garbage, and I say, "Hey, there's a lamp there. It would look great in my
people
room."
People leave books. People leave furniture.
You've got to be kidding.
Yeah, people leave
and
stuff.
And you take it from the dump?
Well,
yeah,
once or twice.
Speaking of Plymouth,
over the years.
Tim is calling from Plymouth. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Hey, Tim.
Hey, how you guys doing?
We're good, thank you.
I love the show. I've been recycling before the Plymouth even influenced it. The big issue is people don't have the right information. Like the guy who just said $180, it's $75 for curbside. It's $180 if you want curbside and to go to the dump. And the other big issue is in Plymouth or in most towns, the bigger towns is you've got this single stream recycling, and 40% of that, actually NPR did an article, 40% of it goes into the dump still, so... I think in the smaller towns, what they need to do is streamline the smaller products. So streamline all your plastic, streamline all of your cardboard. And then in the bigger towns, you have to do this pay-as-you-throw, this all-in-one bin kind of thing, because it's just, there's so much. And
hey,
I think that's
Tim,
the big issue here.
Single stream means you put all your recycling together. Is that what it means?
Yeah, that's what I mean by single stream.
Oh, and when you say people don't know, you mean the guy got the number wrong. But also, I don't know if this is where you're going. A lot of people don't know, despite the fact that recycling has been with us big time for a couple of decades, a lot of people don't know what's recyclable, what's not. Is the pizza box, I know that changed in Cambridge, which theoretically has some grease on it. Is it? I think it wasn't recyclable. Now it is. There's still a lot of public education to do, no?
Yeah, that's one of the big issues, too. The styrofoam, that's not recyclable. It might have the star on it in the five, but it's not. It's a separate type of material. There's also plastic bags with different numbers, and those aren't recyclable unless you compile them together and bring them to a special place that takes that type of plastic.
How do you know so much about this? Tim, why do you know so much about this?
I got interested when I was going to college at Four Seas, and it's just something I've been doing for the past couple of years. I'm only 23, but I was recycling and composting before a lot of towns implemented it.
Great. Good. We're glad to hear from you. Tim, thanks for the call. We appreciate it.
We have another expert who just emailed to complain that we didn't know that styrofoam cannot be recycled. So thank you for caller for explaining that it cannot be recycled.
What do you do with it? No, but
recycled.
She said if it's got the little thing on it,
well,
it can be.
Judith says that we don't know what we're talking about. But she also said, you don't know what you're talking about, Jim, because apparently Cambridge has been debating a pay-as-you-throw program for a long time.
Do they have it?
They are concentrating their efforts on composting first and have a successful pilot curbside program going on in a part of North Cambridge to be expanded to the Monday route in the fall.
I don't live in
And
the,
she also said that food waste takes up 40% of the waste stream. I did not know that.
You know what I do now because of the styrofoam issue, proving that I did know, is when I order a pound of ground beef, I just carry it home with me. I say, they're about to put it in the styrofoam tray. I say, just hand it to me.
Eat a little on the ride home.
No, I'm not going to eat raw ham.
No, well, it's delicious.
Just wash your hands
in
your home. It's fine. Ethel, you're in Lunenburg. You're next on Boston Public Radio. What's up, Ethel? Ethel.
Styrofoam.
Yeah, what about it?
You can call Barbara at 508-872-2323 or go to refoamit@verizon.net or refoamit.com, and they accept egg cartons, food containers, nearly all foam cups, white insulation board. Hello?
Wow.
Yeah,
we're listening.
We're taking it all down.
Okay. Meat and produce trays, pipe insulation, packing blocks, coolers of all sizes, and it also accepts bubble wrap and peanuts.
So what do you say? We missed the first 10 words you said. We didn't have you online here. Are you saying, is this for just Lunenburg, or this is any place they'll pick up?
This is any place. You can bring it there. It's in Leominster.
Great. Ethel.
Ethel, another expert. How do you know all this?
It was in our newspaper.
Oh, well, there you go, in the newspaper.
Ethel, thank you for the info. We're learning a lot today. Michael, you're in Norwood. You're next on Boston Public Radio. What's up, Michael? Michael?
Yes, hello.
Hi, how are you? What's up?
Yeah, I also listen to you all day long in my shop.
Thank you.
What's your shop? You doing French horns, too? What are you doing?
No, I make artisanal breads.
You do? What is with you people?
Oh, my God.
What kind of bread do you make?
Old-style European, very old-school, long fermented dough. We're Boston today, so restaurant in Boston. So.
What's the name of the restaurant in Boston?
Oh, go ahead. Lunch. I do Grill 23, Stephanie's on Newbury.
Yikes.
Hotel, and then some restaurants in my area also. So.
Well, when you're driving home from Grill 23, feel free to stop by One Guest Street and say hi. So, Michael, what's up?
Well, I'm a selectman in Norwood.
Oh.
This issue we talk about every year, budget time. We would save the town about $1.8 million annually if we got into the pantry throw. We're doing single-stream recycling now.
Mm-hmm.
Got into that 7-8 years ago, and upped recycling from about 16% to about 37% almost instantly.
So wait a second, Michael. Michael, you seem to be saying that you're considering this pay-as-you-throw, and it would save $1.8 million, but you're not going in that direction. Is that what you're about to say?
Well, it's more of a political issue. You're looking for a reason why people would be reluctant. There's people who don't necessarily use they don't have kids in school. They don't have they don't use the fire or police, or at least in their own minds they don't.
I got it.
And they're looking for what are their taxes paying for as far as services in the town? If you don't get trash picked up, you can point to snow plowing, things like that. But they see diminishing return on services. And I think that's the reluctance for most people.
Yeah, I agree with you.
And a lot of people dig their heels in on this particular issue. It is, it's a non-starter for a lot of people. I personally am for it, but, I need 3 votes, so.
Well, Michael, thank you for calling, and love to taste the bread sometime. Thank you for your call. How much would you like to be an artisanal bread maker?
I know.
Oh, my God. Can you imagine the smells where he works?
Oh, my God. Can you imagine how much you'd weigh?
Smelling that
bread
in the oven,
coming out of the oven every
French
night.
French horns and artisanal bread.
B in Norwood points out that you just can't trust your fellow man. She lives in a condo.
That's where this selectman just called from in Norwood.
She lives in a condo association of these huge dumpsters, and she said people come by, they're dumping in mattresses, they're dumping in hot water heaters.
Sure.
They're dumping in all this furniture.
What's the problem?
So they have to pay even more for the extra pickup. I mean, I think a hot water heater is pushing the envelope a little bit.
It's hard to carry by yourself, yeah. What I've done, if I'm not driving around, I haven't done that. What my friend has occasionally done, what he will do or she will do, is they occasionally walk backwards. So if they're videotaped being a scofflaw, you don't really know if they're coming or they're going. So this is, were you aware of how widespread this thing was before we started this discussion?
No, I just had those big, huge blue bins that we try to stuff in as much as we possibly
can. Even that is amazing. You know how fast recycling has moved? I know there's still some resistance, but it really has become the norm.
Jim.
And it's only, at least only a couple of decades old. It's amazing how fast it's moved.
It's a beautiful thing.
It really is.
Okay, coming up, we're going to talk to Corby Kummer about the trash to table movement. Putting expired food to use. That is next on 89.7 WGBH. Corby Kummer next on Boston Public Radio.
Back to Boston Public Radio, Jim Browdy and Marjorie. And last time Corby Kummer was here, he went where few people in this profession have gone. He took on the farm-to-table movement. Today we're going to find out how he feels about the trash-to-table movement. That's not fair, but in any case, now that Doug Rao's Daily Table in Dorchester is finally open, Corby's an award-winning food writer and a senior editor at The Atlantic, and he's a regular contributor here on Boston Public Radio. Yeah. Corby, it's great to see you.
Great to be here.
Well, before we get to that very appetizing discussion of trash-to-table.
Actually, it's great. We'll get to it.
I know. You were there. But let's talk about something else that we have talked about in just recent days. This whole movement in New York City to put salt shakers on the menu next to food items in chain restaurants, indicating how much salt is in them, and San Francisco to say on taxi cabs and billboards and so forth that sugar is hazardous to your health, basically kind of a tobacco type thing. What do you think about this? Do you think this is a good idea?
I think it's a good idea, and that unfortunately I fear it's a dog whistle for people like us who think, let's wag our fingers at the ignorant people who don't know they shouldn't be eating too much salt. That's my fear.
I love you, Corby, for saying that.
Well, they are ignorant people who don't know that you shouldn't eat too much salt or too much sugar in San Francisco, which
that's
is why they're doing the ads there.
And that's why you want to wag your finger.
We wouldn't look and feel like we look and feel if we weren't that word you used. Go ahead.
See, the thing is, we all know it, and we think that we can teach the great unwashed by putting a salt shaker on the menu. And I hope it's true. It would be nice if it were true that it actually had an effect on behavior. So until we try it, we won't know. So I think it would be great to try it. I just worry that it's just like these admonishment, finger waggings. Does it actually do any good?
Well, you know, actually, I had a proposal, an alternative proposal I mentioned on TV the night we were talking about this. Instead of having a little image, an icon of a salt shaker, they should have a guy clutching his chest, which don't you think that would have more impact?
Yes. Actually, I was thinking, you know, sugar's hazardous to your health. What does that mean to somebody seeing it on a taxi? I liked the New York City campaign, which Boston also copied a few years ago, which is pouring really gross-looking globs of fat out of a soda bottle into a soda glass. So when there's something really gross and disgusting and visual like that, so if there were some connection between salt and clutching your heart or keeling over on a corner while you're trying to cross the street, that would be different.
Let me just say to you that our listeners, when we discussed this with them, were very open-minded. I just want to read you a little bit from a letter I got from Simon from Somerville. I'll just read the excerpts. Dear former fat person, blaming the government because you were a fat kid, you, sir, are beyond pathetic. Where did your mother learn her parenthood skills? From Sears, Montgomery Ward? You are an emasculated, metrosexual, NPR weenie. And in addition to the other 800 words in this thing that always took Simon a long time to write, he says, go soak your head, tubby. And then he signs. So obviously there's some strong feelings about this.
We learn a lot about that guy by his mentioning Sears and Montgomery Ward, though. I think we kind of learned about his demographic.
But you know, what, though? I was totally with you on this and looked at Jim as the, you know, finger wagging person, because Jim does a lot of finger wagging about what other people should do. But I remember reading a story a while ago, and this stunned me, because my attitude was, who doesn't know that Coca-Cola is loaded with sugar? Who doesn't know that Doritos are terrible for you? And then I read this story talking about, apparently, there are quite a few people who have no idea, which I could not believe was true. And maybe because they're busy or they're not thinking about it or whatever. And so I thought, well, maybe there is an education piece here.
Well, there's a lot. When you talk about high sodium levels and how terrible it is for the diet, you know, there's been controversy about how many people really are affected by this. But the fact is, Americans are eating too much salt and they don't know it. Why do they not know it? There's no salt shaker on the prepared food they're eating. Sure. It just happens to be absolutely jam-packed with sodium to increase flavor, to increase longevity on the shelf. It has nothing to do with flavor. There's all kinds of hidden sodium. And so making it visible, saying, hey, guys, there's a lot of salt in this and you won't know. It's kind of like when I have collard greens from a southern restaurant and I think, oh, leafy greens, dark leafy greens, these are great. And somebody comes behind me, as I remember memorably, when there was Sylvia's in Harlem, this great restaurant, and somebody brought in a big tray, and I was eating a whole bunch of collard greens, and he said, loaded with fat.
Yeah, they are.
And so, yeah, they are. It's all bacon fat, and, you know, it tastes good.
That's what gives it the flavor.
So you don't know there's sodium, and when you're buttering your bread or you're shaking lots of salt onto your food, you know it, you're in charge of it, and it's probably not going to do you much harm. It's the sodium that manufacturers are putting in for all kinds of reasons that don't have much to do with flavor.
Okay, so let's sort of combine a bad idea with a good idea. Bad idea being too much salt and sugar. We have on one hand, we have Dunkin' Donuts contemplating home delivery. That'll really be good for America's health. But something that will be good for America's health, Doug Rao, who's been with us a few times, I had him on television recently. He's a former president of Trader Joe's, so he understands low-cost food. About a year or so ago, he was with us mentioned, I'm hoping to open in Dorchester, which is sort of like a food desert in a lot of ways. I'm hoping to open this low-cost supermarket. A lot of it's going to be with food that is beyond the sell-by date. I know a lot of people think beyond sell-by means it's poisonous. That's where the trash to table line, tongue-in-cheek, came from. And he's opened it. He's opened this thing in Dorchester. It opened several weeks ago. I went there. It is spectacular. A pound of apples. Guess how much a pound of apples cost me?
87 cents.
49 cents a pound. Prepared food. Kale and chorizo soup, $1.59. Salisbury steak and great mashed potatoes, $1.99. It's terrific.
Oh, I think the concept is fantastic. And You know, he's gotten an absolute avalanche of national press and local press, and it's going to be everything I can do to hold off from writing about it right away. But I think all of us have to step back and see, you know, how is the supply chain working for him? How's the execution? Because I want so badly for him to be showing up how other people can do this. And I want chefs to start following the example, too.
You know what I want to succeed most of all? Because I think I remember when my kids were little and you had to get dinner on the table and the homework and the mad dash every day, that the prepared food
right.
thing, so you can get cheap prepared meals. Because lots of people are so tired at the end of the day, or the kids are screaming and carrying on. To be in there chopping vegetables is just unrealistic.
You know, a friend of mine works with them and has been working with them since the launch, and we talked at length yesterday about the growing pains. So the prepared foods are so much bigger a part of the initial plan than I had realized, and they're already going like gangbusters.
Good.
People really want them and they need them. Most of the national press that I saw and local press, it was the whole idea of, oh my gosh, look at your package, look at the milk. Is there anything wrong with the sell-by date? We all have to re-examine sell-by dates. They are stocking issues. They are things that we don't know about and don't need to know about because they don't have to do with the freshness or the food safety in almost all cases. But it's the prepared foods that people need in order to be able to actually serve healthful menus, because that's the huge step. It's not just getting the food into the food deserts. It's not just making it affordable. It's the next step.
Ease.
Of how does a mother put it on the table
yeah.
for her kids? Does she have time? Does she know how to prepare stuff from scratch? That's this huge barrier. And Daily Table is taking this step toward really affordable portions of prepared food that you can give your family. I think that's huge, and I can't wait to look at that.
Let me just say one more thing about it. I mentioned that Salisbury steak and mashed potatoes for $1.99, and I said this to Raul. It is not good for $1.99. It is good. It happens to be $1.99. It was really tasty. It really was fresh. It was good. So was the soup. So I'm hoping there's great. And his hope is to replicate this thing and spread it across the country, start in Dorchester and go other places.
So what I'm going to say,
where people need this.
What I'm going to say, tongue in cheek, is I'm driving from gentrified Jamaica Plain into the middle of Dorchester, and I'm going to stock up on artificially cheap groceries and deprive people who really need them. That is the fear of a lot of people who look at this, that, you know,
yeah.
Newton is going to storm the doors. Newton is not going to storm the doors.
Woman parked next to me in the parking lot when I came out with her Daily Table bag, and I had mine, was driving a white Mercedes.
Oh,
so I don't
no.
know if that's aberrational.
No,
but...
no. I would assume that she likes white Mercedes and she lives in Dorchester. They are aiming for places that are hard to get to with traffic, and that they're not going to have this gentrification effect.
Well, you know something?
I think that's true, too.
Frankly, a lot of people in Newton are afraid to go to Dorchester. So
of
I don't,
course.
They're not going to be going.
Boy, that's a great thing. That's
well,
a,
it's
no,
true.
No, you're absolutely
it's
right.
It's true.
Can we go to the opposite end of the economic spectrum? Marjorie was shocked when I told her this a few minutes ago. There's a story in the New York Times that Oh Yeah, which is this legendary restaurant in Boston, is actually going to New York. That isn't the shocking part. What Marjorie was shocked about when I told her that the price fixed is anywhere from $175 to $250 a meal, I actually have gone once, and I have to say, it is one of the best things. I mean, $200 for a meal is insane. I was embarrassed, and I mostly didn't tell people that I'd gone because it's embarrassing. It is unbelievably fabulous. Now, the portions are microscopic, and so when you first get them, you say, this is the tasting menu. You say, oh, please. I mean, literally, you need a microscope to see most of this stuff, but they're endless. They're great. Is it not a great place?
So is it not a great place? The New York Times did this great series, Frank Bruni, another op-ed columnist, in which for like a year he went to restaurants, and over 2 months, the Times ran it as a countdown for his best new restaurants in America.
Oh,
there were
this.
15,
yeah.
And he was going to the highest, number one. It was the very last one published. By process of elimination, by about 3 weeks from countdown, you knew it was going to be Oh Yeah for his number one. And I wrote him and I said, gee, I happen to have given it a rave, and I'm so glad we have matching tastes. And he very kindly said, I would never have gone if I hadn't known about it for your review. So I am responsible
for
the
surprise. Wow.
Yeah, one of those ridiculous self-aggrandizing and usually false things writers say.
That was a little embarrassing that you did
yeah,
that. But
I
it's great to know.
I
think it's
great he did that.
Nonetheless, I am a great and early fan of Oh Yeah. And when I was reviewing it, you had options that were affordable. For example, I brought my stepson and his girlfriend there. And I thought, so what about a first date restaurant for this place that can easily be over $150 a head? And they naturally ordered, because there was a big a la carte, the things they actually wanted came to about $35 a head. And I thought, okay, that's possible. I do not know in the New York restaurant if that is a possibility. I read at how high the prices were. People, it got its reputation as going for this expensive tasting menu, which you went for.
Isn't it a couple or something? Yes, like Tim one plays the guitar or something?
Yeah, and they had, you know, they're New Englanders, I think, and they had worked in Singapore and at fancy restaurants in Asia, and they acquired this taste in Hong Kong, and they acquired an expertise and this really subtle knowledge of how to make 75 sauces, I remember they said, really? They had made themselves from scratch by hand. And so that idea, that level of customization for you, you know, is really admirable. Plus, it's good. It's not just the fact that it's homemade.
Yeah, may I ask you something? Is it $200 the tasting menu because you're having exotic things or because there's so many courses? Why? Why is it so much money?
Exotic things and the very high price of fish, which when you're going to fancy sushi restaurants, that's the barrier.
Yeah.
And so usually at fancy sushi restaurants, there are ways of ordering around the fancy fish, and they're much more reasonably priced.
Okay.
I should say, for the following 3 weeks, I ate all my meals at Dunkin' Donuts. But
now they can be delivered.
Exactly.
Yeah, speaking of which, I think that's kind of a great idea. Yeah, the delivery service.
Delivering donuts?
Well, come on. We don't have to be eating carrots all the time, Jim. Look, he's over
delivering
there with his 17
donuts?
Carrots,
oh, right.
Wagging his finger at everybody. Yeah, I wouldn't mind.
How is that a good thing?
Because if you have donuts on a Friday morning, you know, once a week, I mean, you're not eating them every day. I've been eating collard greens. I didn't know they were loaded up in bacon fat.
Well, it depends. If you make them, they're not.
I didn't
make
them.
And if you ask what the restaurant does, they're probably not. It was recently National Donut Day, and I thought, wow, this is exactly what my mother always said about Mother's Day. A florist's holiday. It's commercial. It has nothing to do. Of course, if you happen to forget Mother's Day, there was hell to pay.
That is right.
So it was National Donut Day, and I happened to be working in Washington, the line around Krispy Kreme, it was as if people would never be able to obtain a donut again in their lives. So, yes, there seems to be a thing for donuts. But Starbucks is going to institute home delivery. The whole home delivery trend is something we're going to be watching and talking about on this show. I'm really interested in it because it's starting in very upscale neighborhoods as office delivery of, you know, people in the finance business who cannot look up from their screens for even 5 minutes. They will pay for this delivery of meals. And everybody goes online. There's all kinds of customization, all kinds of offerings that there weren't even a year ago. So Starbucks and Dunkin' Donuts locally, seem to feel they need this. You know, I'm wondering about the lattes and the cappuccinos,
yeah,
and the macchiatos to keep
cold.
You looking at the ticker on your screen. That's what I think people are going to be getting delivered.
Yeah, I think so. I think so,
you
too.
Do?
Starbucks has nice donuts as well. I've had the donuts there many times.
Okay, fine.
We see where your mind runs, Barger.
I like donuts. I do. I mean, Jim thinks that they should be banned as well, don't you, Jim?
Yes, I do. Okay, I didn't want to get into that, but since you did. So,
we won't get into it, but Jim has a long list of things he wants to ban. It's
no,
over there in the corner
the
for the
day.
Next
I
time.
Don't
we, did
talk
it.
About
we did it, but
okay,
we just want to point that out.
Can we talk about two men who have, whatever that mortal coil line is? First, Roger Verger, and I'm embarrassed to say I never heard of the guy, a founder of Nouvelle Cuisine, played up huge editorial obituary a few days ago in the New York Times. Is he as big as and critical a player as the New York Times was portraying him to be?
I don't even know what Nouvelle Cuisine is.
Oh, good. So I'm happy to tell you, Marjorie. I'm so glad you asked. So what was Nouvelle Cuisine? It was the idea from Paul Bocuse and Michel Gerard and Roger Verger and others
that you could
throw out the flowery cream sauces that blanketed French food and show the actual ingredients. You could scrape off that sauce and have beautiful trembling baby vegetables smiling up at you from your plate. And duck breast, that was one of the cliches of it. You know, and chicken and these meat, but you would actually see the ingredients on your plate, you'd know what you were eating, and it would have exquisite little napped juices and jus running underneath them that would be this lovely translucent tomato red or sunny yellow of egg yolks, but it was taking off a lot, taking out of the heaviness. But what it inserted, so I like all things that are revolutionary, it became ossified and it in fact was absolutely crammed with butter. So one of the reasons they could make do without flour is that they were thickening all their sauces with butter.
Oh,
and so
okay.
It was actually, you know, much worse calorically.
Oh.
But one thing that it did was it like pulled the curtains back and it scraped off these sauces that were masking maybe inferior ingredients. You actually saw what you were eating, and it made things very pretty. It took a ton of ideas from Asian food. We've just been talking about Japanese food. The beauty of looking at it is so much a part of the experience. This borrowed that from Asia and made French food look extremely pretty.
So when did this happen?
It was also exquisite in Tweez, starting in the late 70s.
Okay.
It really started in the mid-70s. It caught on by the mid-80s, late 80s and 90s. And it did revolutionize food around the world because it brought the focus back on ingredients.
Huh. So, and he was a big deal, obviously.
Yeah, very big deal. Very big deal. Precious.
All right, do we want to ask anything about him? I want to go on to the other guy.
I know you do, and so do I.
The other gentleman, I should say, who you wrote an absolutely beautiful piece for The Atlantic about this gentleman that was a mentor of yours who talked about, well, had the seminal manual called On Writing Well, lived to the age of 82. Tell us
92.
About
it.
92. 92, I'm sorry, 92.
But the greatest thing was I went to see him like a month
Bill,
before
we should
he
say
died.
Bill Zinn.
William K. Zinser.
Zinser.
And the book is On Writing Well. He wrote many follow-ups at writing manuals and been a very prolific columnist for Life magazine and many other places before that. The drama critic of the Herald Tribune, like the highest quality New York newspaper that closed in 1964, in the late 40s, he never looked backward. He was always looking forward. He went blind from glaucoma in his late 80s, and so people started coming and reading to him, and he sent out this incredible letter when he was 90, and he could no longer go to his Midtown office where he wrote every day. Every day he would go and write until he was 90, and his vision prevented him from walking through Midtown to go there. And he sent out this letter saying, come see me if you want to work on your writing, if you want to sing at the piano, because he was a pianist and he had every piece of sheet music ever written because he loved the music of the Great American Songbook. And the end of it was no project too weird. He was completely open to everything. So I get to see every Broadway show through my about-to-end Tony nomination duties. And I thought, he's going to love hearing about the theater. I actually tried to get him to come to the theater. He was completely uninterested. He said, I don't want to know the next damn thing the butler said. I am interested in the world I live in today, and I want you to come and read me pieces from the New York Review or the Atlantic or the New Yorker that tell me something I don't know about the world I live in today. So he was not only interested in that, he helped people write. On Writing Well has sold 1.5 million copies. I was teaching it at MIT this term. We had a moment of silence. The clarity, the freshness, the taking the writer's side and knowing it's really hard to write, but helping you organize your own thoughts. It was seminal, and it is incredibly helpful to this day. It's so encouraging because he was an endlessly encouraging person.
Okay, I want you, speaking of reading things, do you have this piece in front of you, the piece that you wrote from The Atlantic?
No, nope.
I'm going to give it to you.
Thank
because
you.
On page three, Jim, there is a bit of what he wrote about his own mother in her old age. I'll just hand it to Corby because I got it right here.
It is right here.
Okay. It starts about...
She thought it was?
Yes.
So this is
read
so
this.
Great.
This
I was
is
so
great.
Glad I got to know his mother. She thought it was a Christian obligation to be cheerful, and she managed that duty with unfailing grace to the end of her life, keeping to herself the physical and emotional aches and pains of her later years. Today at Easter, it occurs to me that she defined being cheerful as far more than just maintaining a positive and life-affirming nature. I now see that she made it her everyday task to generate light.
Isn't that great? And he wrote that about his mother.
And it's what he did himself.
And I was going to say, like mother, like son, obviously, that this was sort of his mantra, and he inherited this from his mother, and that's the way he went through his life.
And no matter what he, in fact, there was a dinner last night, no matter what he did, he encouraged his students. He said, you're going to get through this writing crisis, and I'm going to help you. And a lot of it was just pairing out words. So one of his students made a fortune in IBM. His name is Paul Francis, and he endowed a chair for writing in honor of Bill. And Anne Fadiman, this incredibly gifted writer in Western Mass, goes down and she's Miss Chips. I went to visit her, and students were literally walking her to the New Haven train station so that they could have every minute. The most gifted young person I've worked with, his name is Dan Fromms. He had a piece last week in New York Magazine. He was a completely devoted Fadimanite. And there's a dinner at the Century Club every year for the graduates of her course. And it really honors Bill's, as Paul Francis said in a letter to me, pastoral instinct. There was something ministerial about him. The idea that you care about every part of your student's life, and after class, after school, they will continue to come to you for advice. Should I take this next job? Is my writing going in the right direction? He never lost contact and interest in his students. That's the inspiration I, as a teacher, want to take with mine.
Okay, let me ask you a question. I'm always amazed when I read stories about people like this who are incredibly prolific and yet have this life as a mentor. How do they have time?
You know, you ask that about every busy person, they make time for the things they care about.
Yeah.
So he just did. And he was always open. He said, call me. He answered the phone. He wouldn't let you write an email. He never had an email address because he wanted human contact.
So if some people are listening now and they're inspired by what you're saying about Bill Zinsser, which of his books should they get? Should they get this On Writing Well?
Is oh, definitely start with On Writing Well.
Okay.
And then The Writer Who Stayed, this collection of beautiful essays. When I say beautiful essays, it sounds like, oh, they're so beautifully written and it's all this lovely sort of impeccable prose. In fact, they're as if he's talking to you right next to you, right into your ear.
You know, he. From what I read, from what you read wrote about him, he was a beautiful writer. With all due respect to him, though, I don't know if he's in the class of Simon from Somerville. Because if we can just end this with
another former fatty.
If I may, you meddling leftists don't even begin to grasp the concept of it's none of your effing business. It's really beautiful. Lastly, Mr. Browdy, let me assure you, no matter how fit you appear on the outside, on the inside, where it really counts, you'll always be that fat, stupid little kid from Philadelphia. Now, I may not agree with everything Simon from Somerville says, but you'd have to agree that he has a beautiful way with words,
beautiful.
Don't you think?
I'm so glad he added stupid. It really elevates the toe. Okay.
I forgot the part about my inflated pea-sized brain. Isn't that sort of oxymoronic?
My question is whether Montgomery Ward sells On Writing Well.
Corby, okay. It's great to see you.
Corby Cummer, thank you so much. Corby is an award-winning food writer, a senior editor at The Atlantic, and he's a regular contributor here at Boston Public Radio. Corby, great to see you. Is dignity on the...
Coming up noon on Boston Public Radio, we'll be joined by the producer of a new eye-opening Frontline documentary airing tonight, Growing Up Trans. No Caitlyn Jenner's here, just kids.
Then Harvard Law School's Lawrence Tribe on recent Supreme Court decisions. Nancy Kane from Harvard Business School on the market basket miracle 1 year after the beloved enterprise nearly tanked. Then we'll ask you, is stressed out? You a vibrating 24/7 basket case? Well, here to the rescue, get this. Coloring books. All that coming up on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Tim Browdy, I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, hour number 2, 89.7 WGBH. Hello again, Jim.
Hey there, Marjorie. So the world watched Bruce Jenner at age 65 become Caitlyn Jenner. But for a new generation, that transition is happening much, much earlier in life.
My name is Arielle. I am 13 years old and I identify as a girl. I haven't really experienced puberty at all. I mean, the hormone blockers are like my lifesaver. But me turning into a man is just probably the most horrifying thing ever I could ever think of in the farthest reaches of my mind is me not going on the hormone blockers anymore and me developing into a man. That would just be horrible.
Arielle is one of eight kids ranging in age from 9 to 19 who shares her story. And Growing Up Trans is a new frontline documentary about children transitioning at younger and younger ages. Joining us is Karen O'Connor. Karen, along with Mira Novosky, is the writer, producer, and director of Growing Up Trans. Karen, thanks so much for joining us and congratulations.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Good morning, Karen. Or good afternoon, Karen, I should say. It was just a riveting piece of journalism. And I think while a lot of us, obviously, the whole world practically knows about Caitlyn Jenner now, but I don't think very many of us know the kids, as you point out in your documentary, as young as 9, are going through this. So tell us the story of one of these kids.
Well, as you said, the film kind of deals with a range of children and their experiences. We deal first with 2 9-year-olds, Leah Hagerty and Daniel Heumann. Both of those kids did what's called social transition, where they've started to live as the opposite sex, but without any kind of medical intervention. So there are a growing number of kids who are changing their names, pronouns, the rest of it, and living as the opposite gender early, sometimes as early as preschool. So that's the first phenomenon we look at. And then around puberty complicates everything for these kids. So that's when parents and doctors and kids face the first decision whether or not they will use what's called puberty blockers, these medications that can suspend puberty and have changed everything for these kids.
Karen, before I get back to the stories of some of these children, I assume this had to be way in the works long before anybody even knew of Caitlyn Jenner. Just sort of a coincidence that's coming out at this time.
It is. We began this film over 18 months ago at Frontline. As you know, we have long research time,
right,
and it's one of the great luxuries that we still get to do, which is to have time to go out and do sort of in-depth research. So, yes, we began this long before Caitlyn Jenner's story kind of hit the front page. It's interesting, though, even in the over a year and a half that we've been working on this film, to see how the sort of social and cultural landscape has shifted even since we started our first research.
You know, Karen, I don't even know where to begin. I learned so much during these 80 minutes watching your piece last night. You just mentioned puberty blockers, about which I knew nothing. And the theory behind this is that you take a puberty blocker, and you'll correct me if I'm wrong, I'm sure, which is reversible at some point, and you have time to make the ultimate decision before you decide to have physical changes made, which are irreversible. Is that not the theory behind this puberty blocker thing?
That's a pretty good summary, Jim. I'm not a physician either, but yes, what we learned is that's really been the game changer within the trans community. Up until 2007, and Boston Children's Hospital here was the first medical center to offer blockers to transgender kids. Up until then, it wasn't possible to really kind of stop puberty the way that it's possible now. So that means this generation of kids have new medical options never possible or imagined even just a decade ago. So what it means is by having these blockers, you are actually allowing a child to never have to go through the biological puberty of their unwanted sex. So it's entirely new.
How widespread is all this? Both the, I don't know if this is the proper nomenclature, the preliminary stuff, the reversible changes, the irreversible changes. When you're dealing with kids, let's say, who are on, you know, I said to Marjorie before we got here, there are, you know, virtually every state has a law banning tanning booths for under 18 years old. And from what I understand, there are virtually no states that have laws regulating this. You'll correct me if I'm wrong there, too. But how widespread is this whole thing?
It's hard to know. Then there are no real reliable, accurate numbers about transgender adults, never mind kids. It's all so new. I think we don't know. The estimates for transgender people in the U.S. range from 700,000 to 1.5 million. Mm. So who knows what the numbers will be. And in recent years, in the last few years, more and more of these families and kids are, as one doctor described it, coming out from the shadows. And so, as you know, in the last year, whether it's New York Times coverage or Atlantic or New York or whatever, we're seeing this described as the kind of new civil rights frontier. And so I think it's too soon to know. Within the medical treatment of kids, it's all still relatively new. Doctors very directly talk about the medical unknowns of what it will mean long term for some of these medications. That said, puberty blockers, for example, have been used in precocious puberty for kids for years, but using them for this population is what's new. So I think, as one doctor says in our film, where they're all navigating this new world together. Yeah. And if we assume both doctors and parents and the kids themselves are doing their best, and that doctors and parents are trying to do right by these kids, it still doesn't take away the kind of enormous complications and dilemmas that come with these complicated issues.
Yeah, and you capture those. We're going to get to some of those complicated dilemmas in just a minute. I just want to re-identify you, Karen. Karen O'Connell, along with Miri Nevasky, the writer, producer, and director of Growing Up Trans, which you can see tonight on PBS at 10 o'clock. You know, you have a little girl, 9 years old at the time you were filmed, Leah, who, talk about precocious. I mean, she's talking about how she began her transition at 6 or 7, and she seems totally together, and she's ready to go full throttle, and she really wants to complete the transition from little boy to little girl and then grown-up woman. And it is remarkable when you see these kids that have gone through these puberty blockers. They don't go through what the adult transgender people do, which is oftentimes, especially if you're a big man, you know, becoming a woman, but you're a 6'3" woman. These kids look so much like the gender they identify with, and they sound and they act. It's sort of phenomenal, and that's the result of these puberty blockers, right?
It's the result of the blockers and then the cross-sex hormones, estrogen or testosterone. But you're exactly right, and that's why timing is critical for the blockers, and that's the dilemma as well. I mean, puberty complicates everything, and then the kind of pressures start to mount, because what they can do now is, with these blockers and these sex hormones, it means, as you said, kids won't have to undo unwanted physical changes. So it is a new look, but timing is crucial.
And one of these little girls, Arielle, talks about how her friends believed her to be a girl until she was like changing her clothes in the locker room.
For exactly those reasons you described. I mean, because Arielle, who was born male but lives and identifies as female, Arielle had blockers at around 11, started blockers, which paused any development of male characteristics, sexual, physical characteristics. So as she said, her idea of a nightmare scenario would be to grow a beard or have an Adam's apple or any of those things that we'd associate with male development. She's been spared that, so she has a very different look. And yes, it wouldn't have been. She was able to enter a new school, living fully as a girl, and it was only 3 months into the new school year that she was outed in a locker room, but. That said, what also is important in Arielle's story is that you see through her friends this other generational shift going on, which we found all across the country, where her friends were incredibly supportive and accepting. So her story carries layers of meaning as well.
Well, speaking of your friends being characteristically accepting, there is a great scene in here where you have a bunch of kind of preteen, and maybe they're, look like they're 12 or 13 boys, basically trying to teach a kid who was a girl and is now a boy the ropes, as they put it, of being a boy. Let's play some of this sound because it's terrific. These are the boys talking about their instruction to this transgendered boy.
Just in general, I've been showing them the ropes of being a guy and saying, like, you got to start working out more. You got to build up that upper body muscle. So
try and talk in a deeper voice, even if it's not normal. Get used to it. Burp. If you have to burp, just let it fly. Don't try and hold it in. Girls do that all the time.
in terms of girls and dating, I'd just say, like, try not to really show any emotion towards it. Just, like, treat her like you don't even like her. Just treat her like that. So, I mean, like, I mean, I'm not trying to make that sound bad or anything, but, I mean, I'm just saying.
Well, the like, tactics and all the information that they're giving me, I definitely use it. Like, sometimes I know that I'll, like, slip up a bit, but their tips are amazing, and I'll go with them.
Their tips are amazing.
Karen,
I love that line.
Thought this was amazing, because you often think of teenage boys not being terribly receptive to things about gender and gays and all that, but this was startling.
You know, we found it sort of all across the country, Marjorie. I think it's just representative in some way of what's happening with this generation. It's also for us illustrative of the gender roles that still exist.
Yeah, no kidding.
Whether in a trans world or not.
So. Yeah, absolutely.
You know, Karen O'Connor, one of the women behind Growing Up Trans Frontline Tonight, you have to say, throughout this whole thing, I'm trying to put myself in the place of the kid. Then, of course, as a father of two daughters, I'm trying to put myself in the place of the parents. And I have to say, the greatest anxiety for me was not in either of those roles. It was in the roles of the doctors. I mean, you had this woman, this Courtney Finlayson, I think it's a pediatric endocrinologist who was terrific. But every doctor says there's virtually no research on this. I believe at some point they say this whole gender dysphoria, this emotional thing where you feel like your biological sex is not the sex with which you identify. But they go on to say that I think it is. In most of the cases, this gender dysphoria, I don't know if disappears is the right word, but at least dissipates. So are they not living in incredible anxiety that they the doctors, are being put in a position to execute a decision that very possibly might be the wrong one? I mean, what kinds of safeguards are in place to ensure that a kid and a set of parents who have bought in didn't buy into the wrong thing too soon?
There's one of the essential dilemmas. It's true. There's very little research. What research does exist is largely anecdotal. What research exists also doesn't take into account this new phenomenon of social transition and what impact that's going to have on that research down the road. So the doctors are very direct and honest about it. That said, estrogen and testosterone have been around for decades. Those are not new medications. What's new, as I said, is using them for this population at younger and younger ages. So they are eager and hopeful to start real studies. I think NIH has awarded Chicago, Boston, Los Angeles, and San Francisco its first grant to start actually doing some real research here in the U.S. So that remains to be seen. But what do you do as a parent, as you said? Puberty itself is one of the most telling predictors. Many of these kids have struggled with depression and sometimes suicide risks and the rest of it beforehand. What do you do when a child is in that kind of emotional pain and is clearly feeling and identifying that he or she is in the wrong body? So I don't know that we have answers in the film. My hope is we've laid it out with as much nuance and complexity as we possibly can.
Well, I think you have, even though I said the first thing I said to Marjorie after I watched it is I cannot believe how together, smart, and mature appearing these young kids are. And while I know your reputation, I know you wouldn't be cherry picking, are these aberrational? I mean, the wisdom of some of these children is so stunning to me. The thoughtfulness. I'm not sure they're right. Who knows? Are these typical kids who have gone through either, as you call it, the social transition or have actually transitioned? Are these typical kids?
It's interesting. We never expected to find kids such as this along the way. So in our experience, we definitely weren't cherry-picking, and we had a kind of – we met kid after kid all across the country who had this were amazingly articulate and expressive. I think it may have to do with the trans experience, though. Ariel, for example, and Alex, and there are many of the kids, most of the kids, have gone through some kind of therapy. They have had years of, in some way, having to account for themselves. And so there is a level of self-awareness and complexity of their own emotional worlds that I think they've had to develop. So probably that's framed and informed everything in their lives. So they've had to kind of explain themselves all along the way, which for our purposes made those interviews just kind of remarkable and stunning in the degree of candor and insight.
Still searching for that level of self-awareness, by the way. I should say the spirit of full disclosure here. You know, Karen, one of the things, you know, after we did the mandatory endless days of discussing Caitlyn Jenner, we would get these what I consider to be condescending memos from organizations that work with transgender people saying, never mention the name of Caitlyn Jenner, never say Bruce, never say she was a man, never this, as if what we were doing was intentionally trying to demean this whole process rather than just going through a learning process. All of those things were not a problem for you. The parents were all willing to talk, the doubters, the supporters, all these kids willing to talk, most of them were willing to talk about their lives before they transitioned. Was that an issue for you at all in the putting together of growing up trans?
It wasn't. And we, for whatever the reasons are, and it may be the kind of the reputation of Frontline, the kind of record of work that exists with our series, people saw this and believed this as an opportunity to tell their stories in a complicated and, I hope, interesting way. And the children and parents were incredibly candid, and nothing was off limits. I think we take great care in our research to get to know people long before we turn a camera on. It's one of the things we get to do. We're not a hit and run. You know, you're not coming in for 15-minute soundbite, and we got a chance to develop and establish some relationships with these people long before a camera roll. So I think that makes a difference, Jim. And the kids in particular, I understand the political vigilance and sensitivity around this issue. We felt none of that with the families, other than I think they felt in general that we were curious and genuinely interested to hear what they had to say. And I hope treated them with some, you know, respect and regard. And they certainly delivered in every way imaginable in taking us as deeply as we wanted to go.
You know, Karen, some of the frank discussion you captured involved one dad, biracial couple, African-American dad. I'm not sure what the mom was, but anyway, biracial couple. And he was really struggling with this. I mean, he was upset when his son wanted to change his name to a male name, upset about the hormones and stuff like that. Even talked about leaving his wife because they couldn't – the mom was much more, let's help the kid, and dad was, let's hold on for a second. So you could capture that, how difficult that was would be for lots of parents. But the thing I worried – hate to be Debbie Downer here is you worried whether too that some of the kids who talked about their depression, talked about their suicidal thoughts, etc., it was about feeling they were like in the wrong body, or if it was something else. You know, you wonder. We all know kids that you know, the little boys that wear dresses for years, and sisters call them Susie, and little girls who won't wear a dress until they're 15 and going to the prom or something, and you think of it as a phase, and that's what scared me too. And you could see there's some parents worrying about that do these kids really know at 10 or 11 that this is what they want forever, you know?
Yeah, I think you really feel that, and I think that is a profound struggle and understandable. That's Burt Blanchard's dad is the gentleman you just mentioned.
Yes, he was great.
And Noel Catrimbone, Kyle's father, who agrees to go to the gender clinic for the first time despite his uneasiness about it, and I think very vividly lays out what it's like to his concerns about letting a 13-year-old drive this. And he sees his role as a parent to protect him from this. But you see, by the end of the film, there's also this shift, seeing what happens, that this, he begins to believe, isn't going to change in Kyle. So what do? You see Laurie and Rajpal Singh, who yeah. have great uneasiness about those medications. But as the dad says so sort of simply but profoundly, doing nothing isn't really an option for their child. So I think, for me, that's what I hope we get close to. These families are not the other. They're relatable, I hope, in a way that may be surprising to people, and they're making an extremely difficult and complicated parenting choice, but it has, I think, resonates for the other difficult dilemmas you face as a parent, where you can't necessarily know what's down the road. This one's especially demanding because it requires certainty at such a young age. That's as the doctor said, these are tough things. It's tough if you do it and tough if you don't. Particularly now if you miss this window of opportunity for these kids.
You know, Karen, I was going to ask you, what's the takeaway, and you just said what it was. Watching, and I have a feeling Marjorie may have been in the same boat, you start by saying, and hopefully not that crassly, that they are the other. And after you watch just 10 minutes and see these kids and their parents, I can't imagine anybody watching this tonight not saying, that could be my kid and I could be that parent. It is so relatable and so common and normal. At least that's how it's projected. But can I move from the spiritual to the mundane before we leave you? How expensive is all this, and does insurance cover it? And what's the reality for families that decide to move forward here?
Again, it's a range, as you see in that one scene in the clinic with Daniel Heumann. Puberty blockers can range from $15,000 to $25,000 a year, which is cost prohibitive for most families. Some insurance companies provide payment more and more are all the time. There are alternatives that are being developed that are less expensive, but blockers themselves are costly. Testosterone and estrogen, not so much, and then surgery, male to female. And female to male, the price can range from $15,000 to $30,000 to $120,000. So, again, Leah Hodson, who you see in the film, the 18-year-old woman at the end of the film, she was one of the first in the state of Connecticut to have her gender reassignment surgery covered by Aetna, I believe it is. So that, according to all the doctors and providers, the insurance is beginning to kind of catch up now with the other cultural shifts that are going on. So it's a wide range, Jim, but it can be costly.
Karen, this thing is terrific.
It is. I mean, it really it's a phenomenal piece of journalism, and it gives you an understanding of these children that I was riveted from beginning to end. Congratulations.
Good luck, and thanks for your time,
Thank
Karen.
You. Thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Oh, we're happy. We're happy to talk to you and thrilled to have seen this piece. We've been speaking with Karen O'Connor, and she, along with Miri Novaski, is the writer, producer, and director of this phenomenal Frontline, Growing Up Trans. You can catch it tonight on PBS at 10 p.m. If you're outside New England, check your local PBS listings for information. Karen, again, thank you so much for joining us. Coming up, constitutional law expert Lawrence Tribe joins us to review some of the most important Supreme Court decisions we've had in the last few days. He is next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie. And last week was one for the ages. Same-sex marriage is now a right in all 50 states and D.C. And the Affordable Care Act, having survived another threat of being dismantled, remains the law of the land. Yesterday, Supreme Court justices ended their term, handing down more rulings that will shape both our future and our nation's identity. Here with us in Studio 3 to review what has been history in the making is Lawrence Tribe. He is the Carl M. Loeb University Professor and Professor of Constitutional Law at Harvard. His latest book is Uncertain Justice, The Roberts Court and the Constitution. Larry Tribe, it's great to see you again.
Great to see you, Jim.
Thank you very much for coming in. A perfect time to be writing about, having written about, the Roberts Court, needless to say. Did you see this coming, the same-sex marriage decision? Did you predict it?
I think most people saw it coming, yeah. Although, you know, everything seems inevitable until it isn't. Yeah. So as the moment came closer, a lot of people who thought this was important, including me, became less and less sure what would happen.
And the Chief Justice Roberts, whose court you've written about, were you surprised with him or not?
Well, I was sort of
hoping... Because he, of course, voted against it.
Yeah, and I thought that was very likely. But I thought there was at least a slight chance, for institutional reasons and because of questions he asked during the oral argument, that he would find a narrow way to join with Kennedy, saying that, well, this is gender discrimination. You know, if Bob could have married John if he had been Barbara instead of Bob, then it's just a matter of gender. But he didn't do that, and I think, I began to wonder, what was I smoking when I hoped for that? But the result was as I expected. But I think it's a remarkably important sea change in the history of the country.
You know, Margaret Marshall was with us the other day, obviously. Mm-hmm. She wrote the Goodrich decision. And Marjorie asked her about the four dissenting justices. And does it ever enter the mind of real people who obviously have exalted positions, I'm going to be seen as having been on the wrong side of history? I mean, it's one thing I'm on the wrong side of a fair housing case or an eminent domain issue.
But this is a major civil rights decision of our time. It's like having dissented in Brown v. Board of Education.
Yes.
So do any of them that you know ever say that to themselves, even in private discussions? Well, I don't want to be remembered that way.
I think that they believe they're right and that they believe that history will record that they stood up for principle, that democracy was the way this should have happened. They claim not to be against same-sex marriage as a matter of policy. They just think it should have happened democratically. But there, I think, Justice Kennedy had a brilliant kind of answer. He said, you know, democracy is great, except when you're talking about putting fundamental rights up to majority vote. And the idea that people can just wait to have their fundamental rights vindicated didn't seem right to him. He said that the pen cannot always erase the results of dignitary harm, and the people who have to wait to have their rights vindicated are not going to be satisfied saying, you know, well, you've got your rights eventually.
And Lawrence Tribe, it always seemed that many of these civil rights cases were decided by the court. That's been sort of our history in many of these
cases.
That's right.
Our history gives the court a fundamental role. That's really the nature, as a very conservative judge, Richard Posner in the Seventh Circuit said, you know, there is a limit to majority rule. It's called the Constitution. And throughout our history, the court has played a dramatic role, not always as culturally and socially dramatic as this time, but there's nothing new in it. That is, if you really took seriously the position of the dissenters, then the laws against blacks marrying whites would still be on the books. The laws against contraception would still be on the books. Abortion would still be criminalized because there is no freedom of choice clause in the Constitution. There's no dignity clause. These are fundamental principles that we discover as we move along.
You know, you mentioned dignity a couple of times now, and there have been a ton of pieces written just in the last few days about the so-called right to equal dignity or whatever it is that Kennedy voiced many a time. And I saw your piece in the Globe saying how terrific the Affordable Care Act decision was. But one of the pieces I read, Lawrence Tribe, says, be careful of what you wish for because it may come back to bite you. Not you personally, but those who are celebrating this right to dignity. And what I read was things like this. Well, if there's a right to dignity as relates to same-sex marriage, maybe you can't violate the right to dignity of someone who says, I don't want to be forced to I don't want to be subject to an individual mandate for the Affordable Care Act. I don't want – this is actually Margaret Marshall on my television show last night said she thinks the next major threshold on same-sex issues is public accommodation. I don't want to take the photographs of a same-sex couple that violates my religious rights because of my right to equal dignity. Same for smokers. Well, Do you not worry that is a slippery slope here?
Well, actually, I'm certain that those arguments will be made, and I'm also certain that rabbis and priests and mullahs who say, I don't want to marry same-sex couples or I don't want to marry interfaith couples, are going to be respected in that way.
How about private citizens who own a flower shop and I don't want to sell flowers to that couple?
I think if they don't want to sell flowers to blacks, they're going to be forced to by the anti-discrimination laws.
Not blacks. But that theoretically has been settled. Well, I don't know. Is there a difference?
I think this has been settled. There is no difference. If they say, I don't want to sell flowers to somebody because that person is gay or has a same-sex partner, I think they are going to be guilty of discrimination. And certainly if they're doing it on behalf of the state, if they're a state magistrate who says, I don't want to marry an interracial couple or a same-sex couple, it's one thing to say, well, you can go to the next magistrate, but if the whole county or a whole city says we're not going to obey the Supreme Court, they're not going to get away with it.
But how about the Affordable Care Act? My right to equal dignity says I should not be required by the so-called individual mandate to buy insurance. That violates my right to dignity.
Well, you can use the word dignity, but the whole idea that shifting economic arrangements and requirements to purchase things or requirements not to hire people below the minimum wage or for too many hours are a fundamental human right, that kind of ended in 1937. And the Supreme Court takes that view. When even Justice Roberts, the Chief Justice, joined his colleagues who said that Congress can't really force you to buy health insurance or broccoli for that matter, he said, but they can impose a higher tax on you if you don't, because you're otherwise a free rider. We're not really going back into the era that equates contract and property with intimate bodily rights or intimate relational rights.
You know, Jim and I were talking about this before you came on, Professor Tribe, and I was seeing this as much more of an equal protection under the law kind of deal where, you know, dignity was mentioned over and over again by Justice Kennedy for sure, but it was an equal protection thing, which is why even though you see all these people online talking about how polygamy is next and marrying dogs and cats are next, I mean, that's ridiculous because no one is allowed to marry a dog or a cat or have 17 wives. So there's no issue of that despite what people may be claiming.
That's right. But someday, I mean, you know, when Chief Justice Roberts said that for millennia, marriage has always been only between one man and one woman,
that's
he forgot
true.
How
yeah.
polyamory and polygamy
right.
has been part of world history. And someday the right to marry more than one spouse might be protected. But there are differences. I mean, you know, if one man is allowed to marry half the women in the county, that reduces the choices available to other men. It hurts other people. But it doesn't hurt anybody when people can marry someone of the same sex.
So what about those clerks in some of these states that are talking about, I'm going to invoke my religious protections and I'm going to refuse to marry gay couples? What happens to them?
Well, I think they are a dying breed, for one thing. I think generational change
yep.
will mean that, you know, there are occasional outcroppings like that. But people are not going to be forced under the lash to do something that violates their religion, except that people are forced to comply with laws like the drug laws, whether they violate their religion or not. And as long as a whole county doesn't take this position, it's a matter of shop, you know, sort of forum shopping. You find
okay.
somebody who will do it. It's not a big deal.
Okay. We're talking with Lawrence Tribe from Harvard Law School. He's written a book about the Supreme Court. Uncertain Justice, the Roberts Court, and the Constitution. You also wrote about what you thought Roberts might do in the Affordable Care Act, and he did what you thought he might do, correct?
Yes, I was quite confident that because, unlike some justices, he looks at the words of a law in context and in terms of what the whole purpose of the law was, that he would recognize that this very clever attack on the Affordable Care Act, too clever by half, that found four words in a sub clause of a 900-page law and tried to transform a law whose obvious purpose was to make health care affordable for everybody into a law that would destroy the insurance markets, I was pretty confident that he would say that that's a bridge too far. And that's exactly what he did.
Even though he does not approve of the Affordable Care Act himself, he's
As
more—
a matter of policy, I'm sure he's against it.
Yeah.
I think he believes it's a bad idea.
Yeah, but can I be hyperbolic here? I would have to say I am surely no constitutional scholar. I don't think that's necessary to say, and you are. If there was ever a case were sticking to the language of a statute ran afoul of what was the obvious intention of the Congress, even if it was all Democrats in the Congress. It was this one. How would the straight face, can these other four characters, well, three, I guess, how can they make the credibly make the case that the intention of Congress was what they said it was?
Well, I think that their position, quite consistent, except when it departs from that
their
position.
Ideology.
It's not always this way, but their position generally you read the words Congress wrote, and if they screwed up, you don't rescue them. You don't pull their feet out of the fire. But when that means hurting millions of people in order to punish Congress for being sloppy, they don't always do that. I mean, for example, Justice Scalia himself, in the last day of the court's term, in the EPA case about mercury, basically said you have to look at the law in context and make sense of it. He said that in lots of cases. So I do think it's really unfortunate for the three justices to say they were being the lawyers and everybody else was being a politician. On the contrary, I think they were allowing their ideology to influence their votes more than the Chief Justice did.
Have you ever written the words jiggery pokery in anything you've ever written, Lawrence Trogg?
Not that I know of, but it's become a term of art. Jiggery pokery and argle bargle and applesauce as a technical way of describing a decision. You know, Justice Scalia is running out of vocabulary.
I doubt that. We're talking to Lawrence Trogg from Harvard Law School about the recent Supreme Court. And we're also going to talk about his, run-in with his former research assistant, who happens to be president of the United States in just a couple of minutes, a case that got totally lost in the shuffle, which I would argue may have huge impact for all of us in this country, is this redistricting thing. Could you give the sort of Cliff Notes version of what confronted the court and what they decided?
Well, the Cliff Notes version is the Constitution says that the state legislature is supposed to do the districting. And most people assume that that meant that once the Democrats or the Republicans are in charge of a legislature, they can cleverly draw the lines so that they can perpetuate the status quo, even if the vast majority of the people in that state end up having a different view. So that's why we see cases where most of the people in the state vote, let's say, for the Democrats, but the representation of the state in Congress is mostly Republican. Mm-hmm. The Supreme Court confronted a case where Arizona, through its citizenry, said, we're sick of that. We think we should have more of a voice. And the citizens of Arizona, by referendum, changed their constitution to say that for purposes of redistricting and drawing district lines, the legislature is us. It's we the people. You know, we've met the enemy and he is us. That's what Pogo once said.
Know him well. And
the legislature took the case to court, and the Supreme Court, 5-4, an opinion by Ruth Ginsburg, said that the legislature does have standing to bring this challenge, which Scalia said no to. But on the merits, they're wrong. The word legislature, if you look at the original meaning in the Constitution, may have meant only the bunch of representatives who meet periodically in the state capitol. But the evolving meaning and the meaning in other contexts has been the organization, the organ that makes the laws. And in a democracy, the most fundamental lawmaking organ is the people themselves. So the net result is that there is now a way for the people in any state to break the hammerlock that the legislature has on drawing district lines. That could completely redraw the map of American politics in the future.
But not any state. States that have allow for the initiative, 25 or 26, like Massachusetts, for example.
That's right. But states can decide by referendum to create the initiative in their constitutions.
You know, this is for those this is one of these things where I'm sure people, you know, watching it on television or listening to you on the radio say, who cares?
That's a big
the
deal.
The impact is huge in
huge.
Terms of this gerrymandering and this self-perpetuation of a Congress, whether you're a Republican or a Democrat or independent, this has potential to undercut all that.
That's right. I think this is the most important decision in terms of long-term potential in the last few years.
You know, just as a quick aside, we mentioned Judge Scalia and his rather colorful language, and he can get very emotional about these decisions. And you also mentioned Judge Ginsburg writing the majority in the case about redistricting. You know, I've read over and over again what buddies they are. I'm often amazed by that because I think, okay, I guess I understand why they're buddies, but what do they talk about? They're so
they talk about the opera. They talk about La Traviata.
That's it.
You know, people can be friends even though they disagree ideologically. I have a lot of friends who are very conservative Republicans.
Yeah.
And they and I talk about all kinds of things. We talk about sports. We talk about opera. We talk about landscape. And sometimes we talk about the legal issues we disagree about. But you don't have to hate somebody in order to disagree with them.
No,
when
that's
Scalia
true.
Said, dissenting from Ruth Ginsburg's opinion, that it was one of the most outrageously illogical opinions he'd ever read, I'm sure they had a good laugh over it afterwards. But they each
she
of them believes
crushed,
it.
I guess. She wasn't
I don't
devastated.
Think so.
Okay.
No, she's
figured...
much too strong to get crushed.
Okay.
Hey, Lawrence Tribe, let's do a little Nostradamus thing for a minute. The conventional wisdom, I think you subscribe to this, is one of the big cases confronting the court. I know they just finished this term, but they'll start another one in October. An affirmative action case coming out of University of Texas, right?
That's right. Abigail Fisher says that even though maybe if her grades were better, she would have gotten in, with her not-so-great grades, it was affirmative action that kept her out. And the Supreme Court, last time the case was there, in an opinion by Justice Kennedy, said that race-sensitive affirmative action is not necessarily unconstitutional, but the lower court had not applied the right standard. So they sent the case back, and the lower court looked carefully at the Texas program and said, well, it meets your standard. And the case is now back before the court with Justice Kagan recused, which means that it's an 8-justice court, and it will all be up to Justice Kennedy. And it's clearly one that he's going to have to think hard about. I don't think he will ever quite say that you can never look at race, but he might say that they didn't look at it in a sufficiently sensitive way this time. And Abigail Fisher might end up winning, and if she does, it won't kill affirmative action. It'll just make it harder.
And was Kagan Solicitor General? Is that what you said? Is that
yes.
why she has to
She was involved in the
thing?
Earlier in sort of incantation of the Fisher case.
She worked for you, too?
She did. She
How
was one of my research
I mean,
assistants.
Seriously, you got to. I'm sure you ask this all the time. How strange is it? Barack Obama, Elena Kagan, who went on to be head of Harvard Law School before she went to the Supreme Court. That's like an out of body experience.
Well, and John
isn't
Roberts was
I
my
forgot,
student.
I forgot. Of course,
yeah.
That's
yeah.
Right.
It is an out of body experience. I feel incredibly lucky to have encountered all these people in this formative part of their lives.
So when you see these kids in class and at 21, 22,
right.
23, they're not technically kids, but they're pretty young.
They feel like kids to me.
Exactly. To me, too. Do you look across and think, I can see Obama, the first black
president. There's a justice.
Yeah. I mean, do some of them stand out? Or I mean, a lot of people are not particularly good students and they go on to do great things. But I mean, obviously, they're smart if they get into Harvard Law School. But have you seen these kinds of things coming down the road?
Well, I can't say I predicted exactly what would happen, but I certainly thought that Barack Obama, John Roberts, Elena Kagan had great futures ahead of them. And Barack Obama was my research assistant. I thought he was an astonishing talent.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
You know, I can't say I foresaw it all.
In what way was he astonishing?
He was brilliant.
Yep.
He had very careful judgment. Just listening to the sermon that he gave recently.
Oh, my gosh.
Friday.
There was a depth to his character and his personality and his ability to sort of channel what's going on with people that was very palpable.
Even then.
So speaking of Barack Obama, your former research assistant, you testified in front of Congress, and you essentially said, and I'm paraphrasing, but not by much, that he is burning down the Constitution, and burning down the Constitution cannot be part of our national energy policy. That latter part you actually said. You were challenging, you're representing coal companies and others, essentially challenging the issue of whether or not the EPA exceeded their regulatory authority on limiting carbon dioxide. I mean, is that a fair statement?
Well, it's an overstatement. I said that the way they were doing it involved violating various limits Congress had imposed, and that issue is still to be decided. The mercury case that the court recently decided was a different issue. But when the Constitution, I think, points in the direction that the president is adopting, I thought that that was the case with the Affordable Care Act and the subsidies. I thought it was the case with immigration. Then I'm very much in his corner. But when I think he has violated the Constitution, I'm not going to say that because I like the guy and respect him and admire him and voted for him that I'm going to ignore what I believe.
Do you have a food taster now, or what do you do?
So I do have plenty of enemies.
What about, was he on solid ground when he announced yesterday, or Monday?
Today, I think.
Yesterday, was it yesterday or today? Anyway, that the people that are entitled to get overtime pay raised the threshold. It used to be $23,000. Now it's up to about $50,000. Was he on firm ground when he did that?
Well, I haven't looked at the order, but I think he's applying it only to federal contractors and their employees. And that certainly is on firm ground. If he tried to sort of change the federal laws of overtime and minimum wage and everything unilaterally, I think he wouldn't be on firm ground.
Okay. We're talking to Lawrence Tribe, the new book, or it's not actually the new book, it's your paperback version
right,
of your book.
Right. The paperback is new, but the book is a whole year old.
Uncertain Justice, the Roberts Court, and the Constitution.
Can I stop for a second? I think you're wrong. This is shocking for me to say to Lawrence Tribe. I don't think it is just federal employees and contractors because, for example, the National Retail Federation is apoplectic. I believe that his contention is that, you know, I believe it was George W. Bush that essentially froze this thing or lowered this cap, 23,660. I believe that he thinks he has rulemaking power. He has the ability to change the rule as to what the threshold is below which workers automatically qualify for time and a half. If I'm right, and I'm not 100% sure I'm right, if it applies to private sector employees, you're quick opinion is he may have violated his authority?
I honestly don't have a quick opinion.
Okay.
I'd have to see the order.
Fair enough. I'm sorry, Marjorie, I interrupted you.
You know, we talk a lot, Jim and I debate this a lot, and you've talked a lot about this in your writing as well, electing judges, that these judges, are, the Supreme Court judges at least, aren't politicians in robes. What do you think? I mean, I think it's wonderful that they're not elected because then they cannot worry about the whims of and the getting booted out for doing something very unpopular. But I don't know. What do you think?
Well, I do worry about how elected judges in many of the states trim their sails in order not to be defeated. And I think it's interesting that this term, the Supreme Court, in an opinion by Chief Justice Roberts, for the first time, limiting campaign activity, despite the First Amendment, said that elected judges can be prevented by law from soliciting contributions. And Justice Scalia, dissenting, said there must be an exception for the cult of the robe. I think it is unfortunate that the Chief Justice seems a little more worried about the political integrity and public respect for the integrity of judges than of political officials. But I think that elected judges presents a real problem. It's certainly contemplated by the Constitution.
Wait, when you say what is certainly contemplated by the Constitution?
The Constitution does talk about judges who are elected and who must take an oath to uphold the Constitution.
Really? How about
yeah,
a middle
explicitly.
Grade? My concern, I am more – I lived in New York City for a long time and there are elected judges there and I thought it actually went pretty well. But I have to say I'm not a student of the issue there either. But it seems to me some accountability other than these lifetime appointments. Mm-hmm. When you see – I mean even Justice Scalia in his dissenting opinion, I think in the same-sex marriage case is talking about this elite bunch of lawyers and
right.
And he's talking about them making law as opposed to interpreting the Constitution, that sort of a thing. But I thought Mitt Romney had it perfectly when he was governor. He did something like this, is after X number of years as a judge, I think it was 10, they would not be voted upon by the general electorate, but there'd be a reconfirmation by, let's say, the state senate or some
well,
such
I
thing.
I think reconfirmation is almost as dangerous as re-election.
Why?
Because it means that you're trying to please somebody. You want to get reconfirmed. But I do think the proposals to limit Supreme Court justices to 17-year non-renewable terms might make sense.
Could that be done statutorily?
Well, there's a split of opinion on that. Some people think that the Constitution guarantees them life tenure. Others say life tenure as judges, but not necessarily on the Supreme Court. So they could serve as judges the way O'Connor and Souter are now and be called in when a recusal creates a deadlock in the court. But you're not necessarily guaranteed on the court.
Why 17? Four presidential terms, plus one?
It's between 15 and 20.
I don't know. Okay. You know, Lawrence Tribe, we've mentioned, obviously, Justice Roberts a lot in the book that just came out in paperback, Uncertain Justice, the Roberts Court and the Constitution. I know he's still a young guy, comparatively speaking. What has he done, 11 years or whatever he's
done? This is his 11th year.
11th year,
okay. Last year was his 10th.
So assuming this is not even midway, but 11 years in, What is the Roberts Court? What do you make of it?
Well, I think that what we make of it will depend very much on an uncertain future. That is, Ginsburg, though very vigorous, not apt to be crushed by the nasty comments of her opera friend Scalia.
Good for her.
Is going to be on there for a while longer, but not many years longer. And Steve Breyer is also getting up there. He's going to be 80 not long from now.
Cambridge kid.
You know, Cambridge kid. No, actually, San Francisco. He and I grew up together in San Francisco.
He lives in Cambridge now.
He lives in Cambridge and in Washington, but he and I grew up at the same time in San Francisco.
Did you know each other?
A little bit.
Oh, really?
But he went to the fancy high school, Lincoln. I went Lowell. I went to Lincoln.
Okay, so two liberal justices.
Yeah, and then Scalia is getting up there, and so is Kennedy. So the court is going to be very differently composed. And as the book that I wrote with my co-author Joshua Matz, who just finished a year clerking for Justice Kennedy, a great year to be there. The book makes the point that all of these caricatures about liberal, conservative are oversimple. I mean, there are certain issues like race-based affirmative action and voting on which Roberts is predictably leaning to the right. There are other issues on which, as we've seen this term, he's much more moderate to liberal, at least in terms of results. So I don't have any crystal ball that tells me where it's all going to go.
You know, Professor Tribe, there's a million polls saying that people think that Congress is doing a terrible job. I think they're down like, you know, below used car salesmen or stuff like that. And then there's, depending on whom you ask, Barack Obama's either doing a good job or he's not doing a good job. He had a very good week last week. And I suppose people's opinion of the Supreme Court might depend a lot on whether they agree or disagree with their latest decision.
Right.
But it does seem to me that they're doing they're the judicial branch that's consistently doing the best job, and I wonder what you think.
Well, I think they're doing a reasonably good job, but how good the job is depends on what your values are.
Exactly.
There's no question. I mean, they're not simply dealing with technical details in the tax code. They're dealing with fundamental questions of the meaning of liberty, equality, dignity, the separation of powers. The Constitution is a very broad, not rigid document, and even the people who rebel at the idea of a living Constitution recognize in their own adjudication that the Constitution's meaning reflects how we understand it over time. And words like liberty are not reducible to a simple code. And so we select these judges by a political process rather than some computer algorithm, partly because we know that their history, their biography, their values, the way they view the world is going to be reflected in how they interpret these broad terms of our Constitution.
But at the same time, when you have so many Americans now being in favor of gay marriage, we've all remarked on the lightning speed, which was gay rights.
Although we're in Massachusetts, and, you know, we don't necessarily see what the whole country feels.
No, but it's 57% nationally in that New York Times poll list.
Some polls say 60%.
Yeah.
I know they're not supposed to be political, but obviously we talked about this at the beginning. Being on the wrong side of history might be a factor. Maybe people look back and say they were right. I don't know that that's going to happen because I think
here it's not going to happen.
So I know it depends on your values, whether you like the decision or doesn't like that decision, but it also depends on they see where the American public is.
Well, they're part
of
it. But there are two different ways of thinking about that. One is sort of that they, you know, put their finger to the wind.
Yep.
They look at where the wind is blowing and they're just weather vanes. I don't think that's it. The other way, though, is they're part of the country. They're part of the culture. Many of them, at least, see the Constitution as an invitation to fill out the meaning of the Constitution in terms of growing understanding. The most dramatic theme in Justice Kennedy's majority opinion in Obergefell, the marriage equality case, was that the framers were smart enough to know that they didn't know everything. There were all kinds of things that would seem to be, you know, fundamentally fair that over time we come to realize don't make sense at all, that are really unjust.
Our eyes are opened. We don't see injustice in our own time. I'm paraphrasing.
That's right.
I mean,
it's
a great line.
Very much, when he said that our eyes are opened, it reminded me of Amazing Grace and of the president's wonderful use of that hymn in terms of how, you know, I once was blind and now I see. And there's nothing about the Kennedy opinion that is more powerful than that. And it's the notion that at least some justices recognize that we don't know everything, and we'll learn over time, and that the Constitution helps us to learn.
Beautifully put. Lawrence Tribe, it's great to see you.
Great
thank
to see you, Jim.
Yeah,
enjoy the rest of the summer.
Thank you very, very much.
Thanks. Have a good summer.
For coming in. Lawrence Tribe is the Carl M. Loeb University Professor and Professor of Constitutional Law at Harvard Law School. His latest book, now in paperback, is Uncertain Justice, the Roberts Court and the Constitution. Thank you again for coming in,
thanks,
Professor
Mark.
Tribe. Coming up, 1 year after the mega protest and a serious power struggle on Market Basket is thriving. Nancy Kane from Harvard Business School joins us for that conversation next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Yes, the slow food movement is still in vogue, but last year Market Basket took it to an extreme. For 2 months, you remember this, the fate of Market Basket was unknown. Last June, a year ago, when Arthur T. Demoulas was fired as the CEO of the homegrown franchise, local employees, 25,000 of them, risked their jobs in protest, demanding that Artie T., as they lovingly call him, be reinstated. It was a summer of massive employee rallies, high-stakes boardroom drama that ultimately ended with Artie T., can't believe I'm calling him Artie T. Artie T. back at the helm. 1 year on Market Basket is thriving. It's making even more money. Here with us in Studio 3 to look at all the ingredients that make this a success and assess where they are now is Nancy Kane. Nancy is an historian at the Harvard Business School. She holds the James E. Robeson Chair of Business Administration. Her latest book is Ernest Shackleton, Exploring Leadership. Hello, Nancy.
Hey there.
Well, you know what I think is incredible? I remember analysts at the time talking about, oh, he's going to have to borrow all this money, RDT, to buy out his brother. $1.6 billion, that was going to mean they were going to not be able to discount as much as they had been. They're going to take away these generous profit-sharing plans for their employees. But that hasn't happened. No. They're expanding. They're doing wonderfully. I mean, this is kind of an unusual example, is it not?
It's amazing. I hadn't, before this story came on our docket here, or came on Chelsea Mertz's suggestion list, I had been thinking about it in kind of the vague recesses of my mind, the summer of Market Basket.
Yeah.
I think we did, the three of us did several shows on it.
Oh, yeah.
And I talked on other GBH outlets about it. So it was such a big deal. And the interesting thing to your observation, Marjorie, is the reverb has from all accounts by all, you know, kind of public source information that we can get been very, very positive. The according to Arthur T., who sat down for an interview with the Boston Globe, dear listeners, I'm quoting from a story published the 27th in the Globe. 1 year after walkout, Market Basket is thriving by Casey Ross. According to an interview, they're paying down the debt, $1.6 billion, much faster than they thought. Sales were very, very robust over the last year, more than they expected, even though they took somewhere between a $530 and $605 million hit in lost sales over the course of the 2 months that the stores went empty because workers refused to work and drivers didn't bring food to the stores and lots of customers migrated to competitors out of need. P.S., right? Those folks have more than come back. They've opened five stores. They're planning two more, including stores with a more upscale assortment of merchandise and fixtures. Lots and lots of emphasis on healthy food. And they paid out hundreds of millions of dollars in employee bonuses. So it looks pretty – and – this is not trivial. It sounds small, but I think it's a big deal. RDT or Arthur T, the family member, I believe they're cousins, Arthur S and Arthur T. Arthur T has replaced much of the board with people that kind of have drunk his Kool-Aid. So it sounds like he's doing what he always wanted to do when he was running the company when his cousin controlled slightly more than half the stock. He's doing what he always wanted to do, which is run it his way,
yeah.
Right? Which includes all kinds of unorthodox business practices. I'm not talking about paying your employees well and knowing the names of their parents and having a sick fund and things like that. I'm talking about he didn't present a lot of financial data to his board. I mean, he was an iconoclastic, unusual CEO when he ran it before he was fired, and I believe he still is. But now he has a board and control of the company to do it his way. No one in the workforce that I know is publicly – complaining. So it's a very interesting year-long anniversary story that we're talking about.
I also want to address one piece of speculation that one of the questions we were all asking, particularly as it came to a close, a successful close, was, okay, are there going to be people who really never went to Market Basket who all of a sudden, in solidarity with the whole deal, treating your employees well, your employees being loyal to the boss? I am the perfect example. I don't know if I'm aberrational. I live about a mile from a Somerville Market Basket. I would say I drove there prior to this whole thing a year ago, maybe 10 times, went in once.
In years? This is over the course of years.
Maybe 10 times. I mostly go to Whole Foods, a little bit of Star Market. But every time I went there, I couldn't get a parking space because it was so packed. I would say 75% of my shopping now is at Market Basket,
really?
Even if I have to wait for a space. And it's beyond the fact that you have colossal value. I mean, even though that X percent automatic discount, I think, expired on December 31st or whatever it was, you get sucked in by the notion that this is a place that actually honors all the rhetoric that we've been spouting forever, that not only treating your employees well is a humane thing to do, but it's also a good business model, which is one of the things we want to talk to you about. But then you get caught up in the whole thing and you feel good about it. And I'm not exactly a feel-good kind of guy, and I love it.
No, you have Jobian qualities to you among many of your other lovable
attributes.
Exactly,
that's what I was going to say, but I'm
attributes,
glad you did.
Jim.
Thank you.
But just to put some color, as we say at the Harvard Business School, on what Jim's saying, I went deeper in this article. So the company is on track to bring in about $4.8 billion in total sales, dear listeners. Their sales are up about, I believe, 3-4% this year. So there are people, sales are up 3-4% in 2015 relative to an industry average of about 2-3%. So they're ahead of the industry. So there must be others, Jim, that are feeling like you, that are coming in, not necessarily loyal before the strike, but coming in now, right? Partly to find out what the magic secret sauce is, or the fairy dust is, and staying, because that's really interesting. And they paid out, I just looked, dear listeners, $129 million at the end of 2014 in employee bonuses. So something is going very, very well here. And I do believe, I've said this before in the show, we've talked about it, that there is a new world here of consumers now factoring in how businesses do their business, how they treat employees, how they treat the environment, how they treat animals, and that is becoming an increasingly important part, not in a very orchestrated, directed way, but in the rapid fire, integrated way that consumers make decisions about where they purchase, what they purchase. That's becoming an increasingly important part of how they make their choices. And I'm sure Market Basket is benefiting from that.
You know, can someone check my math in the control room? When you mention $129 million in bonuses and they have 25,000 employees, quick math in my head, that's $5,000 an employee? That is a huge amount of money.
Please
correct me if I'm wrong about that. But, you know, the 25,000 employees, $129 million, I think it's $5,000 apiece, but I could be wrong. Listen to this one line from the Globe magazine when they recognized the employees of Market Basket or whatever it was. Market Basket employees were the Bostonians of the year. Research appears to bear this out. Well, you'll hear what they bears out in a minute. Historically, stocks of publicly traded organizations, this is a private company, it's not publicly traded. Publicly traded organizations on the Fortune 100 best companies to work for have outperformed the Standard & Poor's 500 and the Russell 3000 indexes, according to so-and-so. The point being, again, and this is, I want you to affirm this or reaffirm this if it's true, that essentially treating your people well is not only a nice way to be, but apparently the records, not just the Market Basket, suggests it's also good for your bottom line.
It is good for your bottom line. There's all kinds of quantitative, not just qualitative, not just anecdotal, not just, storytelling, all kinds of quantitative evidence. This, you've mentioned one piece of it, the correlation between the stock market performance of public companies that end up on the Fortune Best Places to Work index and their market value. There are other very interesting examples of this as well, and quantitative studies correlating literally how companies treat their employees with what their stock price is, and that correlation is strong, demonstrable, and consistent. So it may come as a surprise to lots and lots of folks that want to espouse, sell high, right, and buy very low, including taking lots and lots of costs out of the hides of your employees that, guess what, actually treating your employees well, giving them a career path, offering them benefits, treating them with respect, creating the kind of culture that supports that, guess what? That delivers service, loyal customers, all kinds of productivity and engagement that translate to real increases in the bottom line and therefore increases in the stock price. It sounds revolutionary, but it really isn't. It's just good common sense, not to mention decent long-term value-creating ways of doing business.
$5,160 per employee average bonus is a pretty nice bonus.
That's a nice bonus.
You know how there are certain places you go into and you look and the employees look like they, are working in some death spiral farm or something. They just look depressed and
try calling lots. Yeah, like 1-800 customer service lines,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, I mean, and you see, and it's just, and shopping is a big deal. I mean, I don't go to Market Basket only because it's too far. I mean, it's a long hike for me to get over to Market Basket, especially at rush hour traffic. But I was going over there when I was doing stories on it when I was still at the Boston Herald, and it was unbelievable. This is when the shelves were half empty. You know, the up. Beat of spirit people had. It was really amazing. People that were losing their jobs or risking
losing their income, a minimum.
Losing their income. It was unbelievable. And you go to other places, I don't want to get anybody in trouble necessarily, but we're talking a sad sack situation there where people look miserable. And it just kind of, if you're going to spend 45 minutes doing grocery shopping every week at a minimum, and some of us spend longer, you don't want to be dragged down by the ambiance or lack thereof, you know what I mean?
I think this is true in lots and lots of different encounters, and not just in person. I think phone encounters are like this. Anyone that's ever dealt with emailing questions about a product or a problem you have with a product or a service know exactly what we're talking about. I mean, the experience of service, the experience of buying things, the especially if it's person to person, is a big deal. And we're not just talking about retail companies. We're talking about all kinds of companies. I just finished a week of coaching with 65 advertising folks who had never been through this kind of program before. And we start day one. This is at Babson for Omnicom. I've talked about it before. We start day one with something called the service profit chain, which is a set of research that came out of the Harvard Business School and other places, although I believe the HBS pioneered a lot of it in the early 90s, which was the idea that if you deliver breakthrough, forgive the jargon, breakthrough service to your employees, they will deliver great service to your customers, and you'll create this very profitable cycle in which lots of loyal customers, give you very great positive word of mouth, WOM, as we called it at the time, and they deliver, great profits and lower costs, and that kind of creates more motivated, excited customers who like work employees who like working with happy customers more than they do cranky ones, etc. So there's, again, nothing new from a commonsensical standpoint, but the bet here, here's the way, the interesting thing, and I don't know that this obtains at Market Basket, but I do think customers in the increasingly competitive and fashionable world of grocery retailing. I mean, one interesting thing is to think about...
Is it fashionable?
Well, think about it. Stop and Shop buying Hannaford's. That's partly about trying to get in on a world that now has Wegmans, Whole Foods, Trader Joe's, in which Market Basket is putting in prepared foods, not only prepared food sections that offer lots of healthy food and more organic food, but places to eat within them.
I know, I love that.
So this upscaling of the grocery store experience is a big deal. So the bet here, and I'm not sure that it's going on here at Market Basket, but it clearly is a piece of attracting customers, is you create a philosophy of dealing with your people and of your culture and of your values within the company, and that actually profits and robust revenues and growth result from that. So they are consequences, not ends. So in other words, instead of, oh my God, we got to get this much gross margin, and oh my God, we got to get this stock price, we say, here's how we do business. And what results from that are the kind of things that we're talking about in this article and in our own anecdotal experience. It's a very interesting, small but important shift on the part of managers, business leaders, board members thinking. And I don't think lots of companies are ready to make it, but clearly those that are have enjoyed a lot of success, and it's long-term success. It's not as capricious and dependent on, say, input costs as lots and lots of more of what I would call harsher and more ultimately dismissive modes of running companies in relation to employees are.
You know, there are two things here. One, it seems we all agree, and you're the expert, so it's good that you're you're leading this charge. Treating your people well is good on many levels, including good for business. But this is like extreme. For those who, let me just give you an example. I mean, tomorrow night on Greater Boston, Joe Schmidt is one of the people who's going to join me. Unless I get it wrong, Joe Schmidt, Tom Trainor, I interviewed a ton of these guys. So when you start working, and they're in like their 50s or young. So when you start working at the company,
16. Joe,
when I was 14, yeah. No, really, when did you start working? 14, and you've worked there how long? 47 years. I mean, it's one of these things.
And their brother-in-law works there. And
some
there.
Of them know people that married their, yeah. got no, but, their spouse.
No, that's
got
exactly
married.
Right. Yeah. My son, my daughter-in-law, everybody works
also,
there.
It's also non-union, which is.
Well, let's spend a second on that we finish.
But it's a big deal. In part, this notion about organized labor is it's all about dollars and cents. Also about, I mean, as a former union organizer myself, it's also hugely about how you're treated. And these people were believed to be treated remarkably well. But the part that is amazing to me, that we almost made this mystical, both on the air and off the air, every time I finished a show on television, my former life at NECN, and they were on a lot, like once every couple of weeks, I would say to these guys, and there was an occasional woman, but it actually were more than occasional, but I'd say to these people, how did you work this out with Arthur T?
Yeah.
I mean, what was the strategy? We haven't spoken to him. Wait. Arthur T did not tell you. You worked there 42 years. You're telling me you walked off your job, your family's dependent on your income, and he never winked at you last week and said, don't worry, when I come back, no, nothing. And it came to the point where, who knows, I didn't give him a lie detector test. I assume they're all telling the truth. Their loyalty to this human being was unlike anything I've ever seen, except in a really small company when you see your boss every single day. It is so. The good news, I guess, is further proof on a top of statistics that being good to your workers matters. But anybody who thinks they can emulate or replicate Market Basket has a hell of a long way to go.
They do. And you know, I read an interesting article in preparing for this from, I believe, the Concord Guardian pretty recently about why was this so successful? Because it's non-union, right? And it's, as you said, it has these interesting, very unique characteristics, this family-run corporation. Workers, we talked about this last year, Jim, workers, you know, risking their jobs, walking off the job in order to save a CEO's
job. Their only job in their life.
Right, save a CEO, multimillionaire.
Exactly.
Well, you know, in some ways sounds like a great manager. In other ways, doesn't sound like such a warm and cozy guy. Certainly the family relations are something of out of Dallas, right, or Falcon Crest or, some other torrid reality TV show. In any event, I think a number of things matter. This particular aspect, the family culture, the sense that you could come and build a career here, that's in shorter and shorter supply. Social media is a big deal, folks.
That's huge. That's a wonderful point.
This could not have happened in the same way in 2002. Social media mattered. The fact that you had not just what we traditionally call, and this term I think is more and more anachronistic, blue-collar workers, but you had managers. So some of the people on your show
– Managers, mostly managers. Mid-level
who like,
managers.
You know, kind of helped gather and really, really create the glue and the energy, the flywheel for this. That's incredibly important. I actually think it suggests a whole new concept of thinking about workers that I won't call labor because that sounds like they're cogs, people that work for companies. So there were a lot of different things that went into this. I do think there are still great lessons for companies and for employees thinking about trying to make change, which have to do with new definitions of labor, right? The values of a company, the ultimate reasonableness of these workers. They were extraordinarily reasonable. Here's what we want. We're not fighting for more pay. We're not fighting for longer vacations. Here's what we want, and it matters to us because we think this is good business and the right way to run this company. They just had an extraordinarily powerful and worthy mission that it was really hard to take issue with. I don't care how much you supported the right of Arthur S. Demoulas and that faction to exercise their private fiduciary duty.
It's amazing. It's been a year, isn't it? I mean,
it was the story of the year.
It was just this wildly inspirational, great lesson for everybody.
And P.S., two films coming out about it, documentary films. So, dear listeners, keep your eyes open. Two of them coming out. One at the end of this year and another one probably in early 2016. So this is real news. And I'm sure we'll all hear a lot about them before they air.
Well, I want to see the RDT talking more.
John Hamm is playing. You know, it's interesting you say this. Just very quickly, because I'm joking. We're out of time. It was one of the best moments for me? Because I'd never seen the guy talk, and I've never met
Neither
him.
I
would love to interview him. We'd love to have him on the show.
He's not very
media.
It's when
he finally
He's
stood up
friendly.
And on that platform.
Yeah.
The day He's like an average guy.
Regular guy.
I'm sure he's really smart and really skillful. He speaks like a normal person. He doesn't come. Weren't you expecting a guy 6'3", perfect looking, perfectly tailored, deep voice, whatever? And the guy was just a normal guy who obviously cares about his people, which is really pretty great.
Nancy, wonderful.
Thanks,
to talk
Nancy.
To you as always. That was great. Nancy Kane is an historian at the Harvard Business School, where she holds the James E. Robeson Chair of Business Administration. Her latest book, Ernest Shackleton, Exploring Leadership. And she joins us every Tuesday for Open Mic.
And remember, tomorrow night in Greater Boston, we'll have some of the Market Basket alums. Well, they're still there. The alums of the action will join me on TV.
Coming up, grown-ups are coloring inside the lines, literally. Adult coloring books are on the rise, back-ordered in some places. Are you coloring books to beat the band? Does this kind of idea appeal to you? That's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
I know all about the coloring book story. Oh, my.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Rowdy, Marjorie. And yeah, there are a lot of these empowering gurus out there who tell us we should, what's the expression they use, color outside the lines, bend the rules. Well, are grown-ups doing just that by coloring inside the lines, as in coloring books? Turns out coloring books, this is surreal, it was in a Globe story today, are a thing. According to a study in today's Globe, 5 of the top 30 titles on Amazon's bestseller list are coloring books aimed at adults. So we want to know, is this you? Does the idea of sitting down to a coloring book appeal to you? Apparently it's relaxation. Some say it's like meditation. 877-301-8970. Is this like knitting or needlepointing? Is this some yearning to be a kid again? What is the motivation? 5 of the top 30 books on Amazon are coloring books aimed at adults. What are they called? Colorists? Is that the term they use in the story? Colorists or adult colors something?
When I first heard the term adult coloring books, I thought they must be full of naughty pictures. You know what I mean? I didn't think there were going to be flowers and little animals and little plants, and these beautiful designs and stuff. But I guess it's kind of like people do jigsaw puzzles or something. But I'd be surprised, too. I mean, I don't get the whole appeal. But they say in these stories that it's marketed as a kind of personal therapy session, a simple and solitary alternative to the digital world in which we live. And you can just sit down and lose yourself in the moment of coloring in the lines. I don't get it. But apparently, it's all the fad, Jim.
Well, you know, I was about to say I don't get it either. I don't get the coloring part of it, but are they not totally mindless things? We were just talking about Market Basket. I love going to a supermarket.
I know, you
and
do.
Doing all the aisles, and it's not because I'm buying everything from all the aisles. I find it to be a mindless, sort of mind-numbing, in the best sense of the word, kind of thing. That's what I think this is. I'm assuming you get away from all the crap. You're focused on coloring inside the lines. Maybe it's an interesting story. Maybe it's not. But even though I don't get it, to use your terminology, I sort of do get it. I get the notion that people want a... You know what I would do? When I used to run nonprofits, and I ran a number of nonprofits when I was a little bit younger, I would always do my own Xeroxing. And people would think, my coworkers or my employees would think, it was because I was some sort of egalitarian. It wasn't because I was at all. I really found it to be a wonderful release. You don't think. You just put the piece of paper on the glass. You copy it. You do another one. It's a total release. I know that's it's not quite the same as coloring inside the lines, but I understand the notion of a mindless exercise to give you a break.
Well, you know, you see these television shows. PBS does a lot of them where you have it's the 1700s, the 1800s or whatever, and people are – women are there with their – you saw this in the Wolf Hall thing. Women are there with their embroidery.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're just sitting there silently in their embroidering. And I always think, gee, I wonder if they were having great thoughts while they were embroidering, because there was no television, no sound. I mean, some of these people are probably doing this with the TV on in the background, music on in the background. But that silence that we kind of don't have anymore – so maybe that's part of it. You sit there.
Maybe. I don't know.
Quietly. I don't know. But
it's a relaxing distraction from the world. I mean,
did you read the thing about Brookline Booksmith where they say the phone's been ringing off the hook on a daily basis for requests for back-ordered titles? On the occasion one of those back-ordered titles appear, it's almost instantly gone. While the section at the front of the store devoted to grown-up coloring supplies currently exists in a state of perpetual disarray.
How do we miss this? Did you hear – until until you read the Globe piece, which is written by Dugan Arnett, I think.
Yeah.
Dugan Arnett. Had you ever heard? Have you heard of this?
No, I was just at the Brookline Booksmith, I saw these coloring books. I didn't notice that they were in disarray, but I kind of thought they were for kids.
How about a Jim and Marjorie coloring book? Can you imagine? Does that have huge potential?
Fly off the shelf.
Exactly.
Jim,
let's take some calls. Let's go to Sean in Dedham, who I'm sure is coloring as we speak. Hey, Sean.
Jim, the coloring book that you'd have would be dollar signs as it's packed when you're speaking out of us.
Thank you very much. Luckily, your phone is breaking up. Go ahead, Sean.
Hopefully, I'm clear now, Jimmy.
Yes, you are.
Not help out to the food pantry or maybe coach a sport. I mean, is there something they can do? Can they clean up and get a life?
Sean, we're loose.
Oh, Sean, it's a lousy connection. I'm sorry.
But the basic thrust of Sean is he thinks it's pathetic. Is that a fair? I think it's a fair summary of Sean's rather brief.
Yeah, he wasn't impressed. He wasn't impressed.
877-301-8897. Do you do it if you're an adult? And if you don't do it, do you understand what motivates people to do it? And could you be, so now that you know it, and we lead fairly stressful work lives, can you imagine yourself going to Brookline Booksmith, which we both love, and buying a coloring book?
No.
Neither could I. Let's go to Fall River, hometown of Marjorie Egan. Crystal is on the phone. Hey, Crystal.
Hello. How are you today?
We're great. Thank you for asking.
Long time listener, first time caller.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Oh, I was thinking the coloring book and idea. Well, it's my mother's been coloring since we were all kids. I'm the oldest of 9 kids, and
that
was the only quiet time in my whole entire life was when it was time to sit down and color.
Really? So, would you all color together, like the kids and mom, or was mom coloring by herself?
No, we'd all color together. And now that we're all adults, and my brothers are all in the military, she sits down and colors with my nephews and nieces.
I love
It's a wonderful time to just get together, put the cell phone down, and just do something constructive with your hands for a little bit.
Okay, do you have the TV on while you're doing this?
No. Everything's off.
Wow. Okay, well, that's what it says in the story.
I love this, Crystal.
It's kind of quiet time, and it's therapeutic, and you get away from the frenzy and all the jingling of the cell phones and the iPads and all that kind of stuff.
Crystal, thanks for your first call. Do it again soon, please. I love that story. How much do you can you imagine the scene of everybody in the family sitting down, and instead of everybody being on their cell phone and texting their friends or their whomevers, everybody's got a coloring book. I mean, I can't quite see myself doing it. Crystal's talking about his adults,
you know,
too.
The pictures on the Velveteen, you know, like the Elvis picture that Whitey Bulger was working on with a friend of his was selling out there at the prison. I used to do that.
Do you ever do the little thing on the back of the matchbooks where you color, if you drew the what's it called from the sign? The silhouette of the clown. You could win a scholarship to an art school. I did that all the time.
Really?
I did, yeah.
You didn't win the scholarship?
Not yet. I haven't, but problem is you can't find a matchbook anymore.
Okay, let's go to Jim in Providence. Hi, Jim.
Hello, Jim.
Hi. I just wanted to mention there's a rap artist that I like called Dun B, and he came out with a coloring book of featuring, like, rappers. So it was like current rappers and then like legends, you know, and it was pretty cool.
Did you buy it?
Kind of. No, I didn't. I saw the pictures of it online, but I think you guys are motivating me to purchase it.
Our pleasure.
It's pretty cool. I mean, you can pretty easily make, you know, from an image of someone's face, you can make it cool.
So does this, even though you haven't done it yet and it's one of your favorite rappers, does the concept of sitting down and coloring something have an appeal to you?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. I think your point's about it being sort of, you know, relaxing and it's, you know.
I love that you said, I think so. That's pretty good. Hey, Jim, after you buy the coloring book, send us an email at bprwgbh.org. I'm dying to hear how it went. Thanks.
Right.
Thanks much for the call. 877-301-8897. This is going to be one of these things where by the end of the segment, we're both going to be into it.
Barbara says it's a great way to prevent herself from eating while she listens to Boston Public Radio. Art says, here I thought that talking on the radio for 3 hours a day was Jim's version of mindless activity. Said with the utmost respect and admiration, Art says. So I guess if people, maybe I should try this. Maybe I should try
this. But, despite the fact that we're both acting so surprised, and we're not acting, we are so surprised because purely because we hadn't heard it, almost everybody knows, has a variation on this. I didn't know that millions of people, adults, were coloring. But don't each of them have some special thing they do to be distracted from all the craziness and the anxiety and the...
I know a lot of people that have done things like this to quit smoking. Like a lot of people I know that started knitting, knitting to quit smoking. They wanted to do something with their hands, exactly. Or crocheting or embroidering, and you can make something. It just never occurred to me that you could, you know, get the Secret Garden coloring book, which apparently is like so widely sold out all the time that the author was apologizing because, you know, they were behind and matching the demand for those. But it just didn't occur to me. It seems like a kid thing.
Did I ever tell you I made a rye rug?
To a restaurant with your kid. Remember when your kids were little, you go to the restaurant, they have all the crayons and they have the color and they color there at the restaurant, keep them occupied, you know, while you were trying to eat your dinner thing.
Yeah, let me get back to my question. Did I ever tell you that I made a rye rug? When I was in law school.
I think you did, Jim.
I made a rye rug.
What is a rye rug, please, for
I don't remember, but I know that was the R-Y-A, I think. And it was like a hand-knitted thing. And I actually did it. It was like a whole rug, like a 6x9 kind of thing. And I hung it on the wall,
I used to make potholders.
You did?
That was a big thing.
Well, why is that different from
the,
it's the same sort of
deal. Because I was like six when I was making the potholders.
Yeah, well,
Jason says, as an artist, he thinks coloring books for adults could be a good gateway drug for an individual to find their way to greater, deeper art making. So there you go.
John from Rhode Island, you're next on Boston Public Radio. Hey, John.
Hey, Jim and Marjorie. How are you today?
We're glad to talk to you. We know your voice. You're the guy whose first book was Barefoot by Ellen Hildebrand. Is that not correct?
That is correct. And if I hadn't just started to read books, I might have time to color within the lines. I was never very good at that as a kid either. I gave that up years ago. But I'm going to Martha's Vineyard for a long weekend this weekend, and I'm bringing Rabbit Run with me.
Oh, excellent.
I'm actually going to be one of those people sitting on the beach reading a book.
Excellent.
John, we love you. And is it July 23rd, I think so. July 23rd is Rabbit Run, part of the BPR Summer Book Club, and you are a great contributor, John, and this month. We hope you call again. Have fun on the vineyard.
I can't wait.
877-301-8970.
Let's go to Michelle on the road. What do you think, Michelle?
Hi, Michelle.
Hey, how's it going, guys?
Great, thank you.
I really love your show. I listen to it when I'm driving to work every day.
Oh, thank you.
The commute, nice.
Thanks a lot.
So I have a niece, and sometimes we sit in color. So I'm kind of like jacking her coloring books, but I also I like her her stuff, but I think that the adult coloring books are a great idea. I think that we're always on the road. We're always going. And it's nice to just like unwind, unplug, like not have the TV on, and just kind of like relax. I think crafting is very therapeutic for me.
Yeah.
And it just kind of like, you know, lets you decompress from the day. And, you know, if you want to color outside the lines, you can do whatever you want to do. So
you go rogue.
It's a wonderful idea. Yeah.
Michelle, thanks.
Are there other things besides coloring books that you would put in that same category though?
I would say probably like knitting.
Knitting,
Or crocheting.
Yep.
I like to scrapbook.
Oh, so, scrapbook.
Things like that, like cutting things out.
Yeah.
Like, you know, taking the time, being very detail-oriented. And it's something that you have to focus on, so you can't be doing a million other things while you're doing that.
You know, Michelle, you have said this 10 times better than I did. I kept saying about mindless distraction. You're saying almost exactly what this woman, Sarah Deaver, who is president of the American Art Therapy Association, says in the Globe story. I think it probably speaks to people's enjoyment in doing this kind of relaxing hobby or distraction. And then she goes on to say exactly what you said did. It creates an object of focus, and this is what I hadn't thought about. It creates something that's beautiful, and then at the end is satisfying. Just like the things you talked about you do, you have something at the end that's a product of your work.
Yeah, okay, but then what do you do with it?
What?
It's why I can't be Michelle. Thank you very much for
Thanks,
the call.
Michelle
Great mentioned
call.
Scrapbooking, which I find very stressful because then you have to figure out which pictures you're going to keep, which pictures you're not going to keep. And if you don't keep them, do you throw them out? And the pictures of your kids, and you can really throw those out. It's the same thing with the pictures you threw with the scrapbook, the coloring book. What do you do with them? Do you hang them up on the wall?
Yes,
now?
I hang them on the wall. What I did last night actually, which is why I was late to work today, was scrapbooking. I love her use of verbs. Michelle actually was great.
Yeah,
I scrapbooked last night and then I hung it up on the wall.
But listen to this, people look at Kathy just emailed. She said she started coloring in her son's coloring book years ago to help soothe herself during panic attacks, a drug-free approach. So there you go. Paul says his girlfriend's a clinical therapist who designed a coloring book for her patients about 10 years ago. Again, seems to be very helpful.
This is amazing.
therapeutically.
Let's go to Steve in Norwood. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Welcome, Steve.
Hey, Jim. Hi, Marjorie. How you doing?
Great. Thank you.
Hey, listen, just full disclosure. I went to high school with Sean, and he I don't think he even knows how to read. Never mind.
Wait, did you really go to high school with Sean?
I did. And if he's listening, he knows who this is. Sean's a good guy.
I love that. Did he graduate?
I'm not sure. I was ahead of him in homeroom. So
by the way, we happen to love Sean, as strange as he is.
Sean's a great guy.
Go ahead, Steve.
Sean's a good guy. Listen, my mother got these coloring books. They're called Color Me Your Way. Mm-hmm. And she got them for, I guess, three little boys. And I found myself doing the things for hours. It's ridiculous. It's addicting. It's through different types of pencils and pens. And it's like, the pictures look awesome when you're done with them. So, you know, it's you feel like you're Van Gogh by the end of the day when you color them.
Just don't cut your ear off. So what do you do with them? Like Marjorie said, asked me before, if you do that, what do you do when you're done and you feel like Van Gogh?
You know, you get the Van Goghs, and then my nine-year-old, his doesn't look that much like Van Gogh. I just recycle them. You just throw them away. I mean, there's too many of them, but they are very intricate. And you could spend hours and hours on each one. Really good.
And so, Steve,
check it out. Yes.
Do you use pencils or crayons or both?
I use everything. Magic markers. You know, like the little fine point Sharpies. Like,
yes, sure. I do.
Pilot pens, colored pencils, crayons. You can use whatever you want. It's very, very therapeutic. So,
hey, Steve, when you have a high school reunion, if you and Sean are both going to be there, can you call me?
Absolutely.
Steve,
Sean knows who I am. If he wants to color anytime, he knows where I live. Have him come over. I got one more.
Steve, thanks for the call. By the way, everybody online who we're not getting to, don't do it, but I get it. I'm hoping to buy one. Everybody is, even those like us who knew nothing about it,
now,
apparently.
Imagine this scene, four guys, 40 or 50 years old, yeah, sitting around the picnic table, yeah, coloring.
I can't wait.
What would you make of it, Jim?
July 4th, that's what it's all about.
Okay.
Patriotic coloring book.
Coming up.
Red, white, and blue, fill in those blanks.
The intersection of Hollywood, the Communist Party, and the Great Depression come together in the new book, Girl of My Dreams, by local writer and Academy Award-winning filmmaker Peter Davis. Peter Davis is next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Morning Edition on WGBH is different.
I'm reporter Adam Riley. I came to Plain Ridge Park on a mission. I wanted to see just how much fun $40 would get me. My first stop, a battery of electronic roulette machines staffed by fetching virtual hostesses, some of whom were dressed rather immodestly. When my virtual roulette wheel started spinning, I didn't do too well.
I'm Bob Seale. Start your day every day with Morning Edition from WGBH Radio, Boston's local NPR.
WGBH Radio exists because of you. And Brigham and Women's Vascular and Vein Care Center, with services to help eliminate unsightly varicose and spider veins without surgery. Located in Newton Corner, West Bridgewater, and Foxborough. BrighamandWomens.org/veincenter.
You might not hear a story from the New England Center for Investigative Reporting every day, but every day NECIR investigates. The New England Center for Investigative Reporting, a partner with WGBH News.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie. In the summer of 2015 so far has been characterized by a prison break, 9 people shot dead in their church because they were black, the president of the U.S. deploying the N-word while taping a podcast in a comedian's garage. And all of this is against the backdrop of a 2016 presidential race. We'll have to leave it to the novelist to grasp this moment and find its larger meaning within American history. That's what Peter Davis has done for the 1930s. In his new terrific book, Girl of My Dreams, where Hollywood, the Depression, and the Communist Party all intersect. Peter, as you know, is a writer and filmmaker. He won an Academy Award for his documentary film, Hearts and Minds. Peter, it is great to see you again. Congratulations.
Yes. Thank you. It's great to be back here.
Yes. I heard Jim raving to you about the book in the hallway. That was wonderful.
That was really kind of him.
Yes, it was.
And true.
Well, I'm going to congratulate you as well. But I am curious. I think most people know you from Hearts and Minds, which won the Academy Award, as Jim mentioned. But you've done a lot of documentaries about hunger in America, Skid Row in the 90s, the Berkeley Rebels back in the 60s, and something about race in America, the heritage of slavery back in the 60s as well. So how did you decide to become a novelist? Was it screenwriter, mom and dad? Was that kind of the thing, capturing this era?
Having that childhood that I had growing up in Hollywood, yes, there was always a story for me to tell about that background. Now, the novel takes place in the time before my time. So I grew up in Hollywood in the decades after my story, but my story somehow came to live in me. It wasn't so much that I wanted. It just welled up, and I finally had to tell this story, even though the characters aren't those that I knew growing up, nor is the plot anything like any particular plot, and yet all the stories I heard from the Hollywood of the 30s, before the war, all of that played in. They're true stories. They're also made up. They're fantasies. Hollywood is nothing if not the fantasy capital of the world. But all these stories finally kind of welled up in me.
So, Peter, give us the short version of what is the story that you tell?
The story is a young screenwriter coming of age in a few months, really, in 1934, the spring and early summer of 1934, coming of age at the intersection of Hollywood, the Depression, and the Communist Party, as you said. And all of these things play on him. But the other two main characters are the studio head, who is a rascal, but I hope he's a rascal kind of like to read about, and the movie star, also a songwriter. She does both, whom they both fall in love with.
And at that time, the studio executive, many of whom were legendary to this day, they were the primary drivers of virtually everything, correct?
Yes, they were. In fact, really, the filmmaker in those days, not in all respects, not in every movie, but the filmmaker was really the studio.
You know, is Owen Jant one of your parents?
Is the screenwriter? Yeah, but described as Fitzgerald-like character by one of the reviewers, which I thought was a fascinating perspective as well.
Yes, the Fitzgerald character that you're talking about is the studio head, not the screenwriter.
Okay,
the studio head, Mossy Zangwill.
Yeah.
Could have been Gatsby if Gatsby went west.
Okay,
and built this tremendous. Monument, a studio to himself, a monument to himself. And so Owen Jant is the person that writes about him. And Owen Jant is not either of my parents. My parents were a good deal older. I don't think my parents were ever either as innocent or as devious. Interesting to have a character who's both innocent and devious. Terribly impressionable and wanting only to please, but also in his way, a devious guy who wants nothing more than to succeed.
One of the great lines, I'm going to paraphrase, I hope I get it right, is when this the studio executive sends young Owen up to, where is it, San Francisco.
Yes.
He says, go find me a disaster worse than the Depression. That's what he wants.
That's right.
And what is he come upon there that really that did happen?
Well,
obviously,
he's told to go look into the earthquake of 1906, because it was less than 30 years after that. So there were a lot of people still alive. There were, in addition to people who were in the earthquake and had to escape, which is firemen, prostitutes, by the way, and all kinds of other people. He finds journalists who tell him, oh, yeah, I covered that. But he soon gets sucked into something which one of his guides says a lot bigger than what's going on then is what's going on now, which is the strike. The great longshoreman strike, Jim, of 1934, which is where the legendary union leader, Harry Bridges first became prominent. And so he gets in the middle of this strike, which has several of the most important sections of my novel in it. So Hollywood on the one hand, San Francisco dock workers strike on the other.
We're talking with Peter Davis. His latest book is Girl of My Dreams. He got pretty impressive shout-outs, too, from some of the great writers we all admire, Joan Didion being one, John Irving.
Irving, my favorite.
Your favorite novelist was John Irving. A million years ago wrote the thing about the weird guy that was always paranoid about his children?
The World According to Garp.
He was very, very, very paranoid guy. But anyway, Garp, not John Irving, that is. But anyway, Peter, you know, you talked about growing up after the 30s in Hollywood with your parents, screenwriters. But you must have one or two great stories from that whole period.
My father wrote a movie about Will Rogers, the Will Rogers story. And I didn't usually have much to do with Hollywood. My parents were sort of at a remove from Hollywood, which helped me a lot because I wasn't right of it. I was in Hollywood, but not of it. And my parents, the same thing. Anyway, wrote this movie about Will Rogers. I went to the opening. I was never permitted to do it. I was 15 years old. Go to the opening. There is Mary Pickford.
Oh, my goodness.
You know, yes. Yeah, and lots of other more current movie stars than Mary Pickford. But I was, you know, Gregory Peck, who was a very current movie star. So afterwards, we go to a nightclub called Ciro's. It was on the Sunset Strip. Ciro's and Macambo were the big nightclubs. So I'm with my parents, and I'm on the dance floor with another woman that they happened to know there who was older than I'm, 15 years old. Jerry Lewis is dancing. So also on that dance floor.
And is he a good dancer, Jerry Lewis?
Yeah, but wait a minute. What he did to me shouldn't be done to any teenager. Anyway, I apparently, in some boyish way, resembled him a little bit. And somebody even remarked, the woman I was dancing with, she said, you know, you guys kind of look alike. You could be his son. Anyway, he comes up to me on the dance floor, and the lightweight champion of the world was also on the dance floor then, a guy named Lauro Salas. Anyway, Jerry Lewis comes up. He says to me, hey, I thought I told you to stay in the car. So, well, these things all fed me. There's nothing like that. There's no teenage kid being mocked by a famous comedian in my novel. But all of those things nourished me.
Yeah. That's incredible to be in the to see Gregory Peck and Mary Pickford up close and personal. Like you see them now on television, you have to watch these things when they march in for the Academy Awards. But, of course, you only see them on television, and you can't get close to any of these people anymore like you probably could way back when yes. there weren't like 9,000 paparazzi up there taking the pictures of them.
So, Peter, your whole career has been writing about justice and injustice, and there's a moral to every story. So while this is a novel, there's obviously a moral to the story, 80 years after the fact. What's the takeaway beyond a terrific story about Hollywood in the 30s? What's the takeaway for people 80 years later?
I started to write this book about Hollywood, and then the labor strife in San Francisco came into it. And so I'm toggling back and forth between that. And I wanted to, really my intention was to be in the small world of movie making at that time. And the labor strife, okay, that added a dimension. But as I went along, and I hate to say this, but I went through 18 drafts, something
wow.
between one draft and another, maybe the fifth draft and the eighth draft, something became going on in my novel, and the story began to absorb and reflect and in a certain way recapitulate the larger world beyond movie making and going on strike. And I think there's kind of an umbilical cord between that time and this, the craving for success, the abject fear of failure, the creativity. Much of the creativity in Hollywood migrated from here, from the East Coast to the West. And, of course, the people out there were always complaining about it, always thinking they would have been better off if they were screenwriters, especially if they'd stayed being novelists or playwrights or honest journalists, but not making much of a living that they could make there. So I think the takeaway, I hope, is that there is a larger world reflected and I hope sort of reverberating out from my story.
We're talking with Peter Davis, and his new book is called Girl of My Dreams. Peter, may I ask you a little current events question?
Please.
The reason I do is because, as Jim said when we opened this, you have been a big crusader for justice and fairness, and you've done all these films and documentaries about hunger and the effects of slavery and Skid Row and all these things. We have had a tumultuous summer, as we said in the introduction, you know, actually several months about race relations in America. And you looked at race relations very, very closely back in the 60s. And I wonder what your takeaway is from the police going after young men stories, young unarmed black men in many cases that we've talked about, and last week's horror in South Carolina. Sometimes you get discouraged and think, I mean, Barack Obama reminded us we have come a long way, but sometimes you see these things and think, how far have we really come? And you looked at this. What do you think?
That's a wonderful question, Marjorie. And there happens to be a black man in my novel who is being recruited into the Communist Party. And the guy says to himself, who's doing the recruiting, who's a kind of a hardcore communist, who many, many years later actually becomes what was known in Hollywood as a singer. In other words, he named names. He became not only an anti-communist, but in order to keep his own job. But in this case, back in the early 30s, he's recruiting this black man who is also a butler. And he says to himself, I've bagged my first Negro. This is going to help me so much in the party. Well, then the butler comes up to him at the end of this gathering, which is a sort of a Communist Party party. And a guy says, so we'll see you next Thursday at our meeting, won't we? Because I know that's your day off. You'll come on Thursday. And the black man says to him, you know, there's always going to be some that tell others what to do. I think I'll stay with Mr. Franklin D. And so he says, all right, I'll do what Roosevelt tells me instead of what you guys. Now, or of course, as you say, Marjorie, we've come eons from that. And yet, in another sense, there is still, it's something way beyond racism. Let me give it another word, history. We will never stop paying for our history of slavery. We will always pay, whether it's in the 1930s or the 2015s, as far as we can count in the future. We'll always pay for that. We'll always pay for the Mexican War, where we stole a good deal of territory from Mexico. So, you know, we shouldn't be so surprised at the immigration now, and we shouldn't be surprised at what we're calling racism, but if you don't mind, I'll just call history.
It's Peter Davis, and the name of the new book is The Girl of My Dreams. You don't have this view that I sometimes, maybe I'm being too optimistic, that eventually with so much intermarriage and so many people being a million different things, that by the 2050s things, or certainly maybe a century from now, things will be very, very different because we're going to be a mixed-race country?
I think that they will be different and better. They're different and better now than they were during World War II when the segregation of the races, even during wartime. But it became better when Harry Truman integrated the armed services in 1948. Sure, improvement. But we'll never entirely escape history.
So why don't we have you back in 2050 and we can do an analysis?
I'm for that.
Peter, your book is wonderful and it's great to see you again.
Yeah, congratulations. Peter Davis is an Academy Award winning documentary maker for his film Hearts and Minds. And his latest book is Girl of My Dreams, which has gotten terrific reviews and terrific kudos, even from Jim Browdy here, who's not a big
even.
Well, you're not exactly. You don't get excited about many books, Jim, and you're pretty excited about this.
Move place. Over John Irving. That's what I say.
Okay. Peter Davis, thank you very, very much for
joining
us.
Thank you both so much.
Thanks for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Please tune in tomorrow. We've got our medical ethicist, Art Kaplan. We've got the Celtic Sojourn man, Brian O'Donovan, here to tell us about the hottest venues for music, live music, that is, around town. Our show is a production of WGBH. Chelsea Murs, Will Roselip, Amanda McGowan, Catherine Whalen are our team, and John Parker is our engineer. What do you got on the tube tonight, Jim?
A lot of stuff. Two music powerhouses, Berklee College of Music and the Boston Conservatory, may be merging. The two presidents will join me. Nancy Fraser. Frates, the great mother of Pete Frates of the Ice Bucket Challenge,
oh, yes,
is going to give us an update and talk about their future plans. And then Martha Coakley and Mike Astro, he was appointed head of Social Security by George W., are going to debate some of the greatest hits from the Supreme Court and the Obama administration of recent times.
Okay, that's 7 o'clock tonight. We're at 11 o'clock tomorrow morning on 89.7. I am Marjorie Egan.
I'm Jim Bradley.
Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again tomorrow.